freighter and take what's there. Cause finally the tables are starting to turn. Talk about a revolution.
This week in Radical History for the week starting November 24th. Much of the radical info for this week's show came from the People's Calendar at the Daily Bleed website. This week's show features audio segments produced by the Radio Roots crew at WBAI in New York. And inspiration for the whole kit and caboodle came from the Slingshot organizer. Here we go.
Yo, check this out, man.
There is something going on in the ether.
The kids are now moving back into the street.
For every Martin they cut down, there must be 100 Martins to step into his shoes.
This week in radical history for November 24th starts out with New World Shenanigans, when on this date in 1656, New Hampton, Long Island, now New York, passes laws restricting native movements. After all, they did sell the land for some whiskey and colored beads. New rules against renting land to former inhabitants, not allowing wigwams to be set up without the town permission, and not allowing natives to travel through the area on the Sabbath. You know, honoring God on his holy day by restricting his creatures. Also November 24th, 1898, International Anti-Anarchist Conference, prompted by the assassination of Empress of Austria, is convened by Italian government officials in Rome. 54 delegates representing 21 countries, including police chiefs from several European countries and major cities. The conference marks the development and strategic international surveillance of and exchange of information about anarchist activities. Yes, we are everywhere.
You've come to the wrong shop for anarchy, brother.
Anarchists have a group?
I believe so, sure.
They assemble?
I don't know.
Wouldn't that completely defeat the purpose?
To quote government officials, the government is, quote, crawling with commies, unquote. Like the Hollywood Ten, a group who refused to testify on this date in 1947 before the U.S. House Committee on Un-American Activities about alleged communist involvement. The ten are blacklisted. Some are sent to prison. The chairman of the committee, Jay Parnell, wanting to show us all what it really means to be a good American, is convicted 4 years later for padding his payroll and pocketing the money. Also on November 24, 1963, the first televised assassination, Kennedy assassin Oswald is killed by mobbed-up Jack Ruby. I'm sure it was Ruby's patriotism that brought him to kill the former Marine. More great Americans, for on this date in 1969, Lieutenant William L. Calley is charged with the massacre of over 100 civilians in My Lai, Vietnam, in March of 1968, and is ordered to stand trial and is court-martialed, eventually found guilty, and does a short stint of house arrest. Another great American, future Secretary of State Colin Powell, then First Lieutenant, was in charge of the initial cover-up of the My Lai massacre. Lastly, for November 24, 1979, federal government for the first time admits that troops in Vietnam were exposed to the toxin Agent Orange. Ironically, last week in a buried news story, the U.S. government admits that Gulf War syndrome really does exist, showing once again how disposable veterans are. And thanks for serving. This week in radical history for November 25th, 1500 in Spain, Columbus returns after his third voyage to the New World in chains, although it be a little too late.
This is your radio supporter, Crystal Graham. On this day, November 25th, in 1894, the U.S. military arrested 19 Hopi men for their continued resistance to the government's program of forced education, assimilation, and land seizure. About a month after being removed from their homes and families, the Hopi prisoners were sent to the military prison on Alcatraz Island for, quote-unquote, seditious conduct, and were held for almost a year. The story of the Alcatraz prisoners is just one episode in an ongoing struggle between the Hopi people and the U.S. government. During the late 1800s, there were many U.S. government attacks on the Hopi people's sovereignty and culture as an effort to Americanize them through imprisonment, intimidation, and punishment. Yeah, I said it. This is your free speech educator reminding you to never let the past slip away.
And we're trying to keep history alive by letting you know that on this date in 1904, Ba Jin, also known as Pa Chin, is born, a Chinese novelist who discovered anarchism with the reading of Peter Kropotkin and Emma Goldman, and he created a pseudonym, Ba, for Bakunin, and Jin for Kropotkin. This famous Chinese novelist, Ba Jin, was constantly harassed by the communists, and in 1949 he was forced by them to rewrite his stories, removing or replacing all anarchist references with communist ones. Throughout his life, he is constantly harassed, like in 1966 when he was again disgraced, branded as a great poisonous weed by the Communist Party, as his writings were eventually condemned as seditious. Also on November 25th of 1919, amid a strike for union recognition by 359,000 steelworkers, ultimately successful, approximately 250 anarchist, communist, and labor agitators were deported to Russia yesterday, marking the onset of the so-called Red Scare. George Bernard Shaw would say about this time, quote, "The United States is a country where truth is tarred and feathered, lynched, imprisoned, clubbed, and expatriated as undesirable." George Bernard Shaw. Two more items from November 25th, like in 1997, during a traditional town reenactment of the Thanksgiving myth in Plymouth, police attacked Native American demonstrators, beating and pepper spraying several and arresting 25. History is written by the victors, and we'll be damned if we're not going to keep it that way. Lastly, on this date in 2001, Katie Sierra, a 15-year-old 10th grader at Sensenville High School in Charleston, West Virginia, is suspended for anti-war sentiments and her desire to start a student anarchist club. She self-identifies as an anarcho-pacifist and was kicked out of the school for opposing the Afghan invasion. Quoting her, "I don't know and don't have the answers for the war, but I do know that killing people is not right. I think our country is just too lazy to think of other solutions." She voiced her belief that people at her high school were permitted to talk about how they felt as long as there were others who agreed with them. She denied being anti-American and denies the cries that anarchists imply support of terrorism. She'd eventually win a lawsuit against her high school, but after returning was forced out of school again a couple weeks later as peer threats of violence against her happened. Journalist Amy Goodman, as she covered this situation, would term this event as new McCarthyism. As of 2004, Katie was reported as being a successful sophomore at a university. Now, for the next 4 minutes, you'll be hearing some great work done by the Radio Roots crew at WBAI in New York. People
the time. This is your Radio Roots reporter, Kat Aaron. On this day, November 26th in 1716, a real live lion was exhibited in the city of Boston. This is the first recorded incident of this kind in colonial America. And almost 80 years after this, the first elephant was imported from India to America, which was transported around the East Coast as a public spectacle. By 1834, a company known as the New York Menagerie toured New England with a number of, quote, exotic animals, from elephants and rhinoceroses to polar bears and monkeys. Today, zoos and circuses featuring animals are extremely popular attractions, despite the persistent accusations of animal brutality. Personally, I've always been curious as to why people find wild animals in small cages so entertaining. Yeah, I said it. This is your free speech educator reminding you, never let the past slip away. Say it, say it, say it. This is your Radio Roots reporter, Kat Aaron. On this day, November 27th in 1868, recurring tensions between American colonists and Native Americans mounted in the Battle of Washita River. More closely resembling a massacre, the 7th U.S. Cavalry Regiment, led by George Custer, attacked Black Kettle's sleeping Cheyenne village on the Washita River. Somewhere between 1 and 200 Cheyenne were killed. About 3 months before this, 200 Cheyenne, including Black Kettle, led a raid in Kansas, killing many of the American settlers. While many American history books identify this as what provoked the Washita River Massacre, it might instead be the mass killings of Native Americans by the colonists or the exploitation of valuable land and resources that pushed the Cheyenne to rebel in the first place. What a thought. Yeah, I said it. This is your free speech educator reminding you, never let the past slip away. Say it, say it, say it. This is your Radio Roots reporter, Kat Aaron. On this day, November 28th in 1785, the Treaty of Hopewell was signed between the Cherokee Nation and the United States. The treaty established equality and protection for all Cherokee people, provided that they notify the United States of any possible threats from other tribes. Article 12 in the Treaty of Hopewell said, quote, "The Indians may have full confidence in the justice of the United States respecting their interests." The treaty eventually gave rise to the Cherokee phrase, talking leaves, since they claimed that when the treaties no longer suited the Americans, they would blow away like talking leaves. This accurately describes the fate of the Cherokee, who went on to endure torture and genocide at the hands of the United States. Yeah, S said it. This is your free speech educator reminding you, never let the past slip away. This is your Radio Roots reporter, Kat Aaron. On this day, November 29th in 1781, the Zong Massacre claimed the lives of 132 enslaved African people. The crew of the British slave ship Zong had packed on more slaves than they had room for, causing disease and malnutrition. Upon realizing that the remaining slaves had little chance of survival, the captain ordered that the slaves be drowned in order to collect insurance on them. When they returned to England, the owners of the ship claimed the full value of the murdered slaves, who were legally considered to be physical property. This mass killing of African slaves resulted in a battle against the African slave trade of the 18th century and the eventual abolition of slavery in Britain. The Middle Passage is infamous for its inhumane conditions and the atrocious acts committed on board the ships. Yeah, I said it. This is your free speech educator reminding you never let the past slip away.
More radical history for November 29th, 1864, the Sand Creek Massacres. How the West was won by U.S. Cavalry under Colonel Shivington, a Methodist preacher, in his attack on the Cheyenne and Arapaho people at Sand Creek, Colorado. This unexpected Indian camp is slaughtered despite the white flag of surrender. Having surrounded the camp, the troops butcher over 500 unarmed men, women, and children. After this victory, these fine sons of America scalp and mutilate the bodies, cutting out the female genitalia and attaching it to their hats and sandals. Their bodies are left to rot in the sun. 9 of the 900 cavalrymen were killed, and a local newspaper called this a, quote, brilliant feat of arms, unquote, and stated that the soldiers had covered themselves with glory. No mention that they also covered themselves with female genitalia. Lastly, for November 29th, 1999, welcome to Seattle. The now infamous WTO protests begin. This week in radical history for November 30th, 1554, Roman Catholicism briefly re-enters England under the reign of Mary Tudor. She's also known as Bloody Mary, as she promptly has 300 Protestant leaders burned at the stake. In God we trust. Now, don't leave us out of the fun. Back in the New World in 1624, Richard Cornish is the first person executed for violation of U.S. anti-sodomy laws. Yep, executed. Also on this date in 1854, Fighting Mary Elsa McDowell lives. A social worker, she helped organize the first women's local union of meat cutters in 1902. Comprised mostly of women workers, the local grew to more than 1,000 members. On this day in 1900, an Irish wit, playwright, anarchist, and gay pioneer, Oscar Wilde, 46, dies in Paris, France. While dying in his apartment, Oscar takes one last look at the world he is leaving behind and declares, "This wallpaper is killing me. One of us has to go." Born in Dublin in October of 1854, this poet-writer gay wit published in 1890 The Soul of Man Under Socialism, which is characterized by its libertarian nonconformism. In 1895, he is condemned for 2 years of hard labor for his homosexuality. This flamboyant genius also wrote plays that perhaps perform more often than any other single modern play, the hilarious The Importance of Being Earnest. One more Oscar quote I leave you with. All authority is quite degrading. It degrades those who exercise it. It degrades those over whom it is exercised. Oscar Wilde. More awesome rebel-rousers, like in 1930, labor activist Mother Jones dies. Mary Harris Mother Jones, the founder of the Industrial Workers of the World, IWW, is a militant leader of miners and other union workers, dies at the age of 100. She'd be buried in Mount Olive, Illinois Cemetery. Into her 90s, Mother Jones still roamed through the hills of West Virginia, encouraging miners to organize. When a monument to her is dedicated in 1936, some 50,000 miners attend the ceremony. More rebel rousers. Massive protests continue in Seattle on this date in 1999, and the cops start the beatdown. As Dorothy Day, who died on this date 19 years earlier, once said, quote, "The masters, whether they are priests or kings or capitalists, when they want to exploit you, the first thing they have to do is demoralize you, and they demoralize you simply by kicking you in the nuts." We march together. This has been This Week in Radical History, produced just for you at the Glee Glee Studios. I leave you now with the last part of the Against Me song recorded before they became fucking sellout ass monkeys. Sorry, I didn't mean to offend my cousins, you monkeys. Until next week, as always, I am forever yours in the struggle, Mike Cannon. Patriot, we are the eye, we're the joking. When I scream
marry the state. Cause baby, I'm an anarchist.
Anarchists have a group?
I believe so, sure.
They assemble?
I don't know.
Wouldn't that completely defeat the purpose?
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next.
This Week in Palestine.
طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح من مخيم.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, where each week you will hear the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian perspective, the Palestinian voice exploring the realities of the Israeli occupation of the Palestinian homeland. You will not hear this narrative very often in the Western media, which is why it is important that we present it each week on Truth and Justice Radio. This Week in Palestine was created by Sharif Fahm and is continued in his memory. This is your host, John Roberts. This week we feature a truly remarkable presentation by Boston College professor Eve Spangler. Eve is a sociologist and an activist who brings heart to her analysis of the Palestine-Israel conflict. Her seminal book, Understanding Israel-Palestine, Race, Nation, and Human Rights, is a must-read for those of us who seek to understand the issues at play in Israel-Palestine. Eve spoke at a lecture series sponsored by the Grailta Foundation, a creation of Steve and Barbara Lowe, and held in Lincoln, Massachusetts on November 13th. Here is Eve Spangler speaking in Lincoln, Massachusetts.
And thank you also for devoting one of the last nice Sunday afternoons of the fall to being here. I appreciate your attendance. So as Steve said, I teach sociology at Boston College, and I'm the daughter of Holocaust survivors, and I've done a lot of work on Israel-Palestine for the last 13 years or so. So I want to start out, I'm going to essentially make two arguments today, one of which is that actually Palestinian and traditional Jewish culture are quite compatible. And the second is that we as Americans probably should not be in the business of telling either Israelis or Palestinians how to live. We should, as citizens of this country, be in the business of telling our government what we'd like them to do. And in order to do that, I'm an advocate of using human rights standards as a place to plant your feet. I don't know how many of you, I know many of you are pretty seasoned in this conflict. I don't know how many of you remember back to the first time you began hearing about the conflict, if you had the same feelings I did when I began, which is, oh dear God, this is too complicated. They've been killing each other for hundreds of years. What difference am I going to make? Please bring me some other issue that I can have more impact on. And so I'm also going to argue not only that human rights is a pretty good place to plant your feet, but that if you understand this conflict through the window of the American civil rights and the American black experience, that is very helpful. So that's much of what I'm going to be doing today. I want to, in the pursuit of the compatibility of cultures, I'm going to start with a reading from Rabbi Tarfon, a first century rabbi whose wisdom is codified in Micah 6:8, and I'm going to end with a poem by Palestine's leading poet, Mahmoud Darwish, and I think you will see kindred spirits at work there. So Rabbi Tarfon, do not be daunted by the enormity of the world's grief, I think this is good advice to all of us this week. Do justly now. Love mercy now. Walk humbly now. You're not obligated to complete the work, but neither are you free to abandon it. And so I think that is a very good beginning as a place to speak. So I will start with myself coming into this conflict as the daughter of Holocaust survivors. There are, of course, as many responses as there are survivors, but I think there are two principal ones that are of political import. One of which is never again, and both of them share the never again hashtag. One is never again to my people. And that is a philosophy that leads us fairly directly to Zionism, which is political Zionism, which is what I'll be talking quite a lot about. The other response is never again to anyone. And that leads you to advocacy for human rights standards and to understanding conflicts and letting the chips fall where they may without political expedience and speaking truth as clearly as you can discern it. So what I want to do before I get into details is to lay down just a small stratum of information we should probably all have in common for this conversation. So to begin with, you have the maps on the postcards I handed out, and of course those are somewhat decontextualized. You see there only the Mediterranean and Israel-Palestine. That little bit of land, Israel-Palestine, is a little bit larger than the size of New Jersey. So when you go on a 10-day trip, such as I take my students on, or such as Steve will lead, and I strongly recommend that you do go on his trip, when you go on that trip, you can see quite a lot in 10 days, because you can go north and south and east and west without any difficulty. It's a little tiny place, and it is situated, as you see, at the very eastern edge of the Mediterranean, which is the land bridge between Africa, where the human species originated, and Asia. And it's the land bridge before aviation between Asia and Europe. And so absolutely everybody has been there at some point. And Steve, if you can, this is a little 90-second video. Accustom your eyes. The Mediterranean is up there in the middle. And the timeline is along the bottom. And so let's take a look at everybody who's been there. So as you can see, pretty much everybody has been there, with the possible exception of the Aztec and the Inca. Pretty much everybody has been there at one time. If you remember your Old Testament, the Israelites were sharing the space with the Philistines. Palestine is the Arabic word for Palestine. So there were Palestinians and Israelites way back when. Now, if we fast forward to the present, today in this New Jersey plus a little sized place, you have almost exactly equal Palestinian and in size Israeli and Palestinian communities. There are 6.1 million Israeli Jews, and there are also roughly 6.1 Palestinians, some of them Christian. You have to remember that Palestinians are in fact the first Christians. Jesus was not only Jewish, he was a Palestinian Jew. And all of the places of Jesus' narrative, the Annunciation in Nazareth, the birth in Bethlehem, the crucifixion in Jerusalem, those are all Palestinian cities. So there are 6.1 million Palestinians, some Christian, the majority, of course, Muslim, and they are internally subdivided between Gaza, the occupied West Bank, occupied East Jerusalem, and some 1.7 million are citizens of Israel. Their cultures, I'm going to argue, are actually quite compatible, Palestinian and Jewish culture. Palestinians are ferociously committed to education, for example. They have the highest school completion rates of any Arab population, the highest college graduation rates, the highest PhD rates. You know, I have a close Palestinian friend who told her grandmother that she had just been admitted to a PhD program. And the grandmother burst into tears, and my friend was thinking, oh, she's going to say, but, you know, when are you getting married? And what the grandmother said was, oh, I was so afraid you wouldn't get your PhD. Let's hear it for grandmother power in this room, right? So their cultures are compatible. And economically, they're both very entrepreneurial populations. The German economic historian Alexander Schulz demonstrates how Palestinians had a favorable the Palestinian province within the Ottoman Empire had a favorable balance of trade with Europe throughout the 19th century. So we have here two populations who are educated and entrepreneurial. This is development theory's dream population, a middle-class population, essentially, is what's supposed to make new nations prosperous. And yet, we have managed to snatch defeat from the jaws of victory here. This could have been, and perhaps someday, you know, one hopes will be, truly a land of milk and honey, a beacon in which young Arab men and women looking at what their future might be could say, there is an example of something that is prosperous and democratic and decent. But in fact, that's not what's occurring there now, because these two equal-sized populations, equally educated, equally entrepreneurial populations, are in fact politically divided into an occupying power which enjoys almost unlimited American military, diplomatic, and financial support. The latest memorandum of understanding, $38 billion in military aid alone over the next 10 years, and I will come back to that. And the other population is a stateless, occupied population, half of whom are refugees. And that is a formula for misery, which is what we, in fact, see in the world. And so to understand that, I'm going to argue that Zionism here, political Zionism particularly, is the ingredient that changes everything. Absent political Zionism, the history of Palestine would have been not unlike the history of Algeria or Nigeria or Vietnam or India or Pakistan. That is, a story after the end of World War II of decolonization, of the establishment of a nation state. Could have been more successful, could have been less successful, could have aligned with the West, could have aligned with the Soviet bloc, could have aligned with the non-aligned nations. But what makes this story different is Zionism coming into the area, political Zionism. So I'm starting, and let me be very clear about this, I'm starting with Zionism because I think it changed everything, not because I think it's that Jewish safety is more important than Palestinian rights. Okay, and I think that's important to make, an important point to make. Now, to understand Zionism, I think what's the easiest way to grasp it for an American is through comparison with the American civil rights experience. So in America, you have a black population brought here in slavery, marginalized, ghettoized, mistreated, excluded, and often lynched, right? A murderous kind of marginalization. And the same thing is true for the Jewish experience in Europe. Okay, you have a marginalized, ghettoized, mistreated, often murderously so, even before the Holocaust, murderously so, mistreated population. And let me say as an aside, if people are interested in pursuing this topic, Mark Cohen, a Princeton historian, has written a really interesting book called Under Crescent and Cross, comparing the experience of Jewish communities in Europe prior to the advent of Zionism and in the Arab world prior to the Muslim Arab world prior to the advent of Zionism. And the long and the short of it is, if you were a Jew any time before Zionism and you had a choice between Bialystok and Beirut, pick Beirut. Much better deal. So what does a marginalized, miserably mistreated population, what options do they have if you think about community strategies? Well, the most common one, obviously, is to assimilate, all right, to keep your head down, to try to get along, to go along, to try to persuade your neighbors that whatever difference they're insisting upon to your disadvantage is really not that important. And so we have, not by coincidence, the two most powerful statements of that, one from Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech from the American Black Experience. I have a dream that one day the sons of former slaves and the sons of former slaveholders will sit down together at the table of brotherhood. I have a dream that one day my children will be judged by the content of their character and not the color of their skin, right? That's a very dignified and beautiful statement that says, you know what, a little skin pigment doesn't make that much difference. Come on, guys. Shylock, I know he's written by an Englishman, it's a Shakespeare character, but he expresses much the same. Hath not a Jew hands, organs, sense, affections, passion, fed with the same food, hurt with the same weapons, warmed and cooled by the same sun as a Christian? If you prick us, do we not bleed? If you tickle us, do we not laugh? If you poison us, do we not die? So those are very powerful statements of the assimilationist urge. And I picked, again, a photo off of Google based in African-American life and based in Jewish life to say assimilation doesn't always have to be super conformist, you know, meatloaf and mashed potatoes every Tuesday at 6. It can be, you know, assimilating into subcultures, but the idea is to get along, to go along. And you can see why this is an appealing, even a necessary thing, because for most people, just the work of ordinary life is more than enough. You get up, you get your kids off to school, you go to work, you come home, you pick up the dry cleaning, you reconfirm the orthodontist appointment, you go to the soccer game. You remember to send your mother-in-law the birthday card. And, you know, for most people, that's more than work enough. So that's one possibility. The second possibility, and I'm going to advance this slide. Good luck with that. The second possibility is you try to reform the system which mistreats you. And clearly, in the case of African Americans, that is the civil rights movement with different aims. Some of it has different subsets, have different aims, schools, jobs, banking, home ownership, different means, integration, segregation, violent, nonviolent. But there is a Black Lives Matter writ large movement. And for Jews, the reform movement was most often socialism. Socialism for a number of reasons. The first of which is, of course, socialism raises questions of economic justice. And despite the anti-Semitic stereotypes that Jews own all the banks in the world, if you are a ghettoized, marginalized, mistreated population, likely you are also poor. And so questions of economic justice are compelling. Secondly, socialism is inherently global, transnational, and Jews in Europe lived within many different nation states, and so to have a global strategy was helpful. And lastly, I think, and I'm indebted to Joseph Massad, a cultural historian, for this insight, socialism also, if you believe the doctrine that the proletarian class is the carrier of human advance for all of humanity, socialism allows you, by being a proletarian, to play on history's winning team without having to renounce or be embarrassed by your Jewish identity. So the most common attempt was reform was socialism. Now, if, however, you are that subset of the Black or the Jewish community who believes that nothing will work, they won't let you assimilate and you won't be powerful enough to reform them, then what you can do is leave, right? You can exit. And so we had in civil rights history a Back to Africa movement in the Black community, right, that said, we'll never be accepted here, we'll never be safe here, we have to go back. And we have in the Jewish community Zionism, political Zionism, we have to go somewhere else, away from European Christianity, and we have to build a safe house of our own, a room of our own. That is the political project of Zionism, an ethno-religiously exclusive state somewhere in the world. Now, I don't want to overdo this analogy. We should acknowledge at the outset that clearly Israel is economically a more successful political project than Liberia, is a more economically and a more politically successful project than Liberia. And that's a big except for. But nevertheless, except for that, there are startling parallels between the Back to Africa and the Zionist movement. The first one is that the vast majority of people who were supposed to be the beneficiaries of going back to Africa or going somewhere and building an ethno-religiously exclusively Jewish state never really accepted that appeal and never bought it, right? They said, in effect, you want to go where? you want to do what? And so the alleged beneficiaries were not as enthusiastic as the program called for. But, however, the second parallel is that both movements, Back to Africa and Political Zionism, had great leaders, very powerful leaders, who could secure the political consent of the dominant nations of the world to creating a new state, who could raise enough money for the enterprise, and who could recruit some number of followers to go and be settlers in this new place. The third parallel is that, in fact, Herzl, Theodore Herzl, the founding genius of Zionism, The third parallel is that both movements had allies. And those allies were a very mixed bag. Some of them were genuinely people who believed in human rights and who said, hey, if you're that unhappy, what can I do to assist you? But many of the allies were racist and were all too eager to assist in a project that would take black people out of white America or would take Jews out of Christian Europe. Herzl, the founding genius of Zionism, in fact, said, the anti-Semites will be our greatest allies, okay, because they will pay to help us get out of Europe, okay? The choice of site, fourth parallel, the choice of site was largely opportunistic. Most American slaves do not come from Liberia. They come from Ghana or Nigeria. And many of them, by the way, were Muslim because there was a trans-Saharan slave trade. So I found out only relatively recently that there was a significant Muslim population within the American slave population. But the site of Liberia occurred because the United States had control over that land and could donate it. And likewise, the choice of Palestine, which sounds counterintuitive given the biblical claim, was also a little bit opportunistic. When the Balfour Declaration in 1917 was issued by the British government saying that His Majesty's government looks with favor upon the establishment of a homeland for the Jewish people in Palestine, there were already flourishing Zionist colonies in Argentina, funded by the Baron de Hirsch. And the Zionist leadership, Herzl and Nordau and others, were not 100% sure, even though the British clearly were using the biblical argument to say, okay, you know, go to Palestine. The Zionists themselves were not so sure about that because it had a bad reputation as a kind of white man's grave. And Herzl very clearly wanted a place appropriate for European gentlefolk. And so the first Zionist Congress, which was the political arm of Zionism, sent a delegation of rabbis to Palestine and asked them to cable back to the first day of the first Zionist Congress their assessment of the real estate. And the rabbis did as bid, and they cabled back. Cables, of course, have to be succinct. And they were even succinct and poetic, and they said, quote, the bride is very beautiful, but she is married to another man. The bride is very beautiful, but she is married to another man, which meant that the leadership of the Zionist movement, not necessarily the rank and file, but the leadership of the Zionist movement knew from day one that to make this an ethno-religiously exclusively Jewish place would require ethnic cleansing, which was referred to in early Zionist language as the transfer. And let me, to be fair, say the notion of population exchanges or transfers in the 1870s was not such an anomaly. There were transfers in which all the Christians were supposed to leave Turkey and come to Greece, and all the Muslims were supposed to leave Greece and go to Turkey. That ended in mass slaughter. There were various population transfers being bruited about. This is the heyday of European arrogance, that you draw lines on pieces of paper in Whitehall and you say to millions of people, get up and move over there, and let's have these people move over here. So the transfer is a little perhaps less perverse than it sounds, but from the very beginning, Zionism was committed to transfer. And what the last parallel, the fifth, is that once they got to their promised land, Liberia in the case of Back to Africa, Palestine in the case of Zionism, they rode roughshod over the rights of the indigenous population, who were not part of their picture of the kind of community that they wanted to build. So now we have today Israel, and they tell us that they want three things. Of course, to be Jewish, indeed to be exclusively Jewish, and they've said this since Herzl's day. Herzl said, "We will be the ramparts of Europe in Asia, the ramparts of civilization against barbarism." Now, you know, that would be an unpleasantly racist remark from somebody back in the 1880s. We need to move forward. But its continuing relevance is attested to by the words of Ehud Barak, a former Israeli prime minister, a former Israeli defense minister, potentially a future Israeli prime minister, who refers to Israel as the villa in the jungle. And we know who the jungle bunnies are, right? And Netanyahu, who says Israel has to fight the wild beasts all around it. So the Jewish identity is a given of what Israel wants. Israel says that it wishes to be a democracy, and it tells us repeatedly, that it is indeed the only democracy in the Middle East. But very early on, people were already beginning to think, wait a minute, there are a lot of Palestinians here, and you want to build a state that's ethno-religiously exclusively Jewish, so how is this democracy thing going to work? So Martin Buber, the philosopher, said, excessive nationalism can lead only to a tiny state of Jews, completely militarized and unsustainable. And Hannah Arendt, whom you'll know from her work on the Eichmann trial, political philosopher, said, a Jewish homeland, because there was a debate in early Zionism between a cultural version of Zionism, which was to acknowledge that Jews have ties to the Holy Land, and to add Jewish settlers into a multicultural and egalitarian society. That was cultural Zionism. Political Zionism aspired to an ethno-religiously exclusive state, and Arendt, weighing in on that debate, said, a Jewish homeland should never be sacrificed to the pseudo-sovereignty of a Jewish state built on Arab suppression. So the question of democracy was always problematic. And then, of course, the Zionists said they want all the land from the river to the sea, from the Jordan River to the Mediterranean. And they have been, from the beginning, unambiguously clear about that. Jabotinsky, one of the early Zionists, says, it is the iron law of every colonizing movement, a law which admits no exception. If you wish to colonize land in which people are already living, you must provide a garrison. Zionism is a colonizing adventure, and therefore it stands or falls on the question of armed force. That's pretty clear. David Ben-Gurion, writing to his son Amos in 1937, writes a letter. The British, there had been riots, and there was a general strike, and there was agitation by Palestinians against Zionism and against the British Empire. And the British do what they always do. They sent in a commission to study it, the Peel Commission, that recommended partitioning Palestine into a Jewish and an Arab state. What would have been allocated under the Peel Commission to the Jewish state was a pretty small patch of the Galilee. And so there arose a debate in the Zionist circles as to whether we should take the deal or hold out for the whole, you know, take a third of the loaf or hold out for the whole loaf. And David Ben-Gurion, later the first prime minister, wrote to his son, I am certain we will be able to settle in all other parts of the country, whether through agreement and mutual understanding with our Arab neighbors or in another way. I say erect a Jewish state at once, even if not in the whole of the land. The rest will come in the course of time. It must come. We will make it come. Okay, and Benny Morris, the leading Israeli historian, says it's impossible to evade it. Without uprooting Palestinians, a Jewish state would not have arisen here. These are circumstances which justify ethnic cleansing. And that's Israel's leading new historian, Benny Morris. So what I think this suggests to me is that being Jewish, democratic, and having all the land doesn't work. You can't have all those three things at once. You can have any two. And so you can have what is called the universally agreed upon two-state solution, in which you are Jewish and democratic because you have withdrawn, and if you have the maps to the third panel of the map, you pull back what are now settlements, you pull back to the areas where Jews are a super, super majority, and therefore you could be Jewish and democratic, but you will allow some land to go to a Palestinian state. This universally agreed upon solution, which was imposed by the United Nations with General Assembly non-binding resolution 181 in November 1947, was agreed upon by everybody except two parties. I'm going to let you guess which two parties didn't agree. The Zionists and the Palestinians, neither of whom wanted their land divided. Okay. The other thing about the universally agreed upon two-state solution is that what we're talking about is an area slightly larger than New Jersey. So we're talking about two microstates, East New Jersey and West New Jersey. Okay? I mean, it's easy to say two states for two people, but we're talking about something the size of East New Jersey and West New Jersey. If you look at the map, it's pretty much gone, because in the fourth panel we have today's situation, which is the green bits are what remains for Palestinians, is where Palestinians now can exist. And that means it's not contiguous, there's no possibility of sovereignty, there's no possibility of economic viability, unless you want to use Micronesia, a nation state of islands, as a model. This is not a sovereign, viable contiguous model. So it's gone. And Noam Shizof, in fact, a very smart Israeli writer, argues that the Israelis want neither the universally agreed upon two-state solution, nor do they want a single binational democratic state. You could create a situation in which everybody can move freely throughout all the land and you have a democratic state. Then you would have to think about a binational state like Canada or Belgium, right, with multiple languages, multiple holidays, recognize the school curriculum, recognizing both cultures. So you could do that. It would be very, very difficult, I think, in both communities for Zionist leaders to retreat from the political Zionism of an ethno-religiously exclusive state to the cultural Zionism of being a community and a multicultural nation. And I think it would also be very difficult for Palestinian leaders to say, you know, the dream of having our own nation and our own postage stamp and our own flag and our own anthem is dead, and we are now going to, you know, change from a national liberation struggle to a civil rights struggle, a struggle for rights within a single nation state, which, you know, clearly is what I would recommend, but I can see why it would be very, very difficult for Palestinian leadership to get up and say it's over. The dream of national liberation is over. Although Sam Bahour, who's a very prominent Palestinian-American businessman, the founder of Paltel, says that his daughters constantly say to him, "Dad, what we need to do is we need to stand up and we need to say to the Israelis, you won. You won. You've got all of the land. You've got all of the water. And hey, you've got all of us. Where do we sign up for our voter registration card?" One hopes they would vote at a higher rate than some of our American peers. In any case, there is the possibility of a single democratic state, which, funnily enough, is being talked about both on the left and the right. Naftali Bennett, who's in Netanyahu's cabinet, has said that the two-state era is over. We're just going to annex the West Bank. And about 25% of Palestinians are talking about a single state. About 80% by polling data would still like a two-state solution, but that same 80% believe it will never happen. So we are, I think, at a breaking point. Here's where Noam Shizof's work comes in, I think, significantly. He says Israel will not allow either a one- or a two-state solution because they prefer perpetual occupation. They don't want a one-state because clearly they're not going to give equal rights to Muslims and Christians. And second, they love American Christian tourists, but that's different from Palestinians who are Christians. And they don't want a two-state solution because then God knows who the Palestinians would elect. So what they really want is perpetual occupation, particularly since it costs them almost nothing because it is heavily subsidized, the costs of their occupation, by American foreign aid and EU support. So what we have, in fact, at the moment is that we have a Jewish state, indeed, from the Jordan River to the sea. There has been only one government for, by next year it will be 50 years, one nation state in charge of the whole place. And it administers this land in a way that deeply compromises democracy. And we're beginning to see not only the Israeli state, but some of its American supporters, like Sheldon Adelson, saying openly that democracy is irrelevant. Sheldon Adelson recently said, the Old Testament doesn't mention democracy. Why make such a sticking point about democracy? So we have a very ugly situation of occupation. And let me say that there are, I think, two major ways that occupation is enacted. One is physical brutality and suppression, and the other, and indeed the more common, is bureaucratic. So this is a photograph taken by one of my students. This is if you go on the trip, which I recommend you do, this is Shahada Street in Hebron. As you can see, it's a very wide street. There's a concrete barrier that divides it three quarters, one quarter. Palestinians who live in Hebron are only permitted to walk on that small side of the street. And if they own cars, they're not allowed to bring their car into the city. They can park it outside the city and walk to the car, but they can only walk on this narrow side of the street. You see an Israeli soldier watching. These are boys walking home from a mosque soup kitchen. You can see the Israeli soldier making sure that no Palestinian walks on the Jewish-only side of the street. You see that little booth? That is a checkpoint. Because beyond that booth, the same street continues, but in the next block, Palestinians are forbidden from walking even on the narrow side of the street. They're absolutely banned. And because Palestinians do not give up their homes easily, there are Palestinians who remain resident on that street, including our tour guide, who has half his face and hair burnt away from acid that was thrown on him by illegal settlers. If you continue to live in the block beyond that checkpoint, and you're not allowed to walk on your own street, what you have to do is to go over to the next street, find a neighbor who will open their door, allow you to go up on the roof, walk across the roofs, and down into your own house. So that means forget about emergency EMTs coming, you know, if grandpa has a heart attack, forget about buying a new stove, because you have to go rooftop to rooftop. In addition to that kind of physical separation, there are, of course, 750,000 illegal settlers under international humanitarian law. It is absolutely illegal for an occupying power to move civilians into the occupied territory. So we have 750,000 illegal settlers. Let me tell you one more quick story. I'm going to wrap up fairly quickly. Of physical domination. One of the bus drivers who's worked with us for years is a guy named Ayman, and he's generally a pretty happy-go-lucky kind of guy, and he interacts very affectionately with students. And on the last trip, he was just morose one day particularly, and so I sent the students off to see Lifta, which I'd seen many times before, and I sat with Ayman and I said, "You're kind of grim today. What's up?" And he replied, "Well, my nephew was killed last week, and today we learned that there will be no investigation." And, you know, being an American, I said, "Oh, my God, was he driving too fast? Was this, you know, a driving accident?" And he said, "No, the army killed him." And I said, "Well, tell me the story." And he said, "Well, he lived in this little village outside Bethlehem, and he got, by email, he's 17 years old, got his very first college acceptance. And he was beyond happy, excited, and all his friends showed up dressed up in their best clothes, and he said to them, 'How did you guys know I got into college?' And his friends said, 'Oh, we're not here to celebrate you. Don't you remember there's a wedding in the next village? Put on your good clothes. We've got to go to the wedding.' So he scrambled into his wedding suit, and off these 17-year-old boys went. You can imagine laughter, shoving, noise. So a nearby illegal Israeli settlement, the settlers called the army and said, "There are those noisy Palestinian young men. We're scared." And the army said, "Okay," and they came in, and this little 2-kilometer dirt road between the villages, they declared as a closed military zone. Now, they didn't post any signs saying it's a closed military zone. They didn't go to the wedding party and say, "When you go back, that's a closed military zone, go some other way." They just sat there on the path. So after the wedding, these young men are walking back in the middle of the night to their village, and suddenly they're surrounded by Israeli troops. And these are young Palestinian men in a closed military zone. That's the equivalent in America of driving while black. And so the army demanded that they show their ID, and everybody showed their ID except Ayman's nephew, who had dressed hastily, and his ID was in his jeans, on his bed, in his house. And all the young men said, "No, no, he's one of us. He lives right there. He's one of the villagers. But he is a suspiciously dressed up young Palestinian male with no ID in a closed military zone." So one of the soldiers, a woman, walked up behind Ayman, smashed him in the back of the knees with her gun butt. He fell to the ground. She put her gun to his head and blew his brains up. And what, you know, Ayman, looking particularly grim that day, told me is they just got notified by the army that they had investigated and the soldier acted within her rights and there would be no further action taken. So that's the kind of physical brutality that we hear witnessing of. But in fact, the more common is bureaucratic. And so you have in Israel today 4 different legal systems. Okay? You have the legal system for Israeli Jews. And there's a very peculiar thing that happens in Israel where you have both citizenship and nationality. Now, Americans use nationality and citizenship interchangeably. I'm an American citizen, I'm American national. It means the same thing. But in Israel, citizenship and nationality mean 2 different things. So for an Israeli Jew, you have both citizenship and Jewish nationality, and therefore all legal rights. If you're a Palestinian citizen of Israel, you may have citizenship by virtue of being born in Israel, and you do have some rights. You may go to public schools. You can enroll in the public health service provisions. You can vote. You can indeed even be elected to the Knesset. You cannot buy land, and you do not have the right to family unification. So if you have a Palestinian citizen of Israel who comes to study in America and meets a Palestinian from Gaza or a Palestinian from the diaspora and wishes to marry them, they will not be granted permission to live together inside Israel. So you have some rights. If you are a Palestinian in the occupied territory, you are tried and answerable to military law. Military law, the military courts produce a 97% conviction rate for people fortunate enough to come to trial, because a part of military law is also what's called administrative detention, in which you can be arrested and held for 6 months by the security forces without being told what the charges are, without being charged, without confronting the evidence against you, without right to counsel. And that 6-month administrative detention can be extended indefinitely in 6-month increments by going to a military judge and saying, "We're not done with this guy yet." The longest anyone's been kept in administrative detention is 11 years. So if you have a son or a grandson who went to a demonstration, if this young man got arrested at a demonstration and he was 19 at the time, he'd get back to his family at age 30. And then in Jerusalem, in East Jerusalem, you have neither citizenship if you're a Palestinian nor nationality, but you may be issued a residency permit. And thereby hangs the last story I want to tell you about bureaucratic domination. We have Mahmoud. We visited Mahmoud 1 year in the city, the town of Al-Walaja. Al-Walaja is a neighborhood within Bethlehem. Literally, if you get in a car in Al-Walaja and drive to the Church of the Nativity, it's a 3-minute drive. And so Mahmoud is sitting in a very pleasant house, and we go there for tea, and he tells us he's just come back from prison where he was arrested for trespass. And so we say to him, well, Mahmoud, where were you trespassing? And he says, I was sitting here in my living room. And we say, we need some explanation. And he says, well, see, this house is in Al-Walaja. And the Israelis have rezoned Al-Walaja from Bethlehem to Jerusalem. Now, Bethlehem and Jerusalem are a distance. You're going to need to help me out, you Lincoln folks. Lincoln to Bedford, maybe?
Not even.
Lincoln to Concord. So it's taking a little corner of Concord and rezoning it into Lincoln. The problem, watch closely, is that now Al-Walaja is part of Jerusalem, but no Jerusalem IDs were issued to any citizen in Al-Walaja. And so Mahmoud is sitting in a home that his grandfather built, that his father was born in, that he was born in, and his three children were born in, and he is arrested for trespass because he is in a Jerusalem home but without a Jerusalem ID. The second year we went back, Mahmoud was gone, but the house still stood, demolition orders having been issued. The third year we went, the house was gone, and the fourth year we went, the wall was snaking through the property, and over the wall was the roof of a McMansion. So this is the ongoing expulsion, and it's bureaucratic, right? So I'm going to open it to questions and answers. I'm simply describing what I've seen and what I've studied and what we see and what you can see if you go on this trip. But I want to close with, as I promised, a poem by the Palestinian poet Mahmoud Darwish, because I want to leave you with some hope. And the hope is that the human beings living there do have the potential to live in peace and equity. So this is a poem called Think of Others, and it's by Mahmoud Darwish. As you prepare your breakfast, think of others. Don't forget, feed the pigeons. As you conduct your wars, think of others. Don't forget those who want peace. As you pay your water bill, think of others. Think of those who can only drink the rain. As you go home, your own home, think of others. Don't forget the refugees who sleep in camps. As you go to sleep and count the stars, think of those with no place to sleep. As you educate yourself with metaphors, think of those who have lost their right to speak. And as you think of distant others, think also of yourself. Say, I wish to be a candle in the darkness. So, hoping that all of you will be, in one way or another, a candle in the darkness, I'm going to open it to questions.
You have been listening to Professor Eve Spangler of Boston College, speaking in Lincoln, Massachusetts. We hope that after hearing his presentation that you will read her book, Understanding Israel-Palestine, Race, Nation, and Human Rights in Conflict. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Special Executive for Counterintelligence, Terrorism, Revenge, Extortion. The four great cornerstones of power, headed by the greatest brains in the world.
I'm sure the West would welcome a scientist of your caliber.
The Americans are fools. I offered my services, they refused. So did the East. Now they can both pay for their mistake.
World domination, same old dream.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. All along the watchtower of Bristol's city walls, briefing two tonight with 2008 and the death of capitalism. Our series on authoritarian Britain examining the building blocks of the police state being assembled around us. Briefing two tonight on the death of capitalism and the greatest heist in history. Day after day we're expected to believe there's not enough money for this, not enough money for that, whilst nearly £700 million is found with hardly a question to refurbish the offices of Queen Elizabeth, the richest woman in the world. So are we being sold a putt day after day, night after night, by the London media? Is this just a glorified smash and grab by the rich and powerful, a kind of criminal elite? Tonight we put Martin Summers through his paces, old Labour Oxford economist, as we take a good look at the money system and how some people get a licence to make money up out of nowhere while others starve. And what really happened in 2008, how the threat of cutting off our money is used to control us and how to fix this rotten system. Plus the religion of war. From last week, we look back to the last Republican president, George W. Bush's Iraq victory speech, and how those words seem so hollow now. And the brave new technocratic world, we hear from author of Brave New World, Aldous Huxley. our sister show Dialects here on BCFM 93.2 at noon every Tuesday. Next week, we've got more from Vanessa Beely, who incidentally is the daughter of a British diplomat who was British ambassador to Egypt, Martin. I don't know if you realised that, in the 1970s and 1950s, and was involved very much in as a diplomat in the Suez Crisis. Also, a look at the Trump election. Some more views from around the world from American expat, this time Rich Nyland over in Germany. That's Dialect on Tuesday at noon. But anyway, we start this week by talking about some of the hotspots around the world. Martin, obviously Syria again, but Iraq this week, a truck bomb yesterday killed 100 people at a petrol station. I suppose many of us will now sort of, I suppose, have forgotten to point the finger at Tony Blair and George Bush for this sort of thing.
Though Tony Blair is apparently coming back into British politics because he feels that he's wanted. I don't know where he gets that idea from, but there you are.
This sort of attack in Raqqa, I think it was, in Karbala, yeah. Is killed almost exclusively Iranians who were celebrating a major Shia religious holiday in Karbala.
Well, I mean, the obvious, you know, you never know exactly who's to blame for these kind of attacks. The obvious finger to point would be towards Sunni extremists who are fighting in alliance with ISIS. But then on the other hand, you've got people who want to stir up trouble who might do that in order to create the impression that Sunni extremists have carried out the attack.
Well, there's this thing called crisis initiation, isn't there, which the Israelis are famous for. Most people don't talk about it. They will just talk about it, I suppose, at places like Sandhurst, etc. Of course, to get a crisis going, you've got to have atrocities by apparently one side or another. I mean, we hear about this as being a truck suicide bombing. Well, there's no reason, isn't there, that someone couldn't have put a bomb in somebody's truck and then exploded it remotely. It might not be a suicide bombing at all.
Yeah, well, as you say, why would you use a suicide bomber when you could just put the bomb in the truck and you don't have to have a suicide, you don't have anybody committing suicide anyway.
There's a psychology, isn't there, to the way we're told time and time again, suicide bombing, and of course the journalists simply don't question it.
Yeah, but sadly, it is quite easy to hit soft targets like pilgrims who are going to a shrine. It's very easy. And those, whoever they may be, who want to do that, can do it if they wish, and they do.
Now, you're saying that these people may have been aligned with ISIS, but we know that the ISIS is supported by the CIA, by the West, etc., particularly through Turkey, you know, that they're actually a NATO ally.
Indeed, and I think there's evidence to show that the civil war in Iraq between the Shia and the Sunni elements within the population was deliberately fostered as a divide-and-rule tactic by the occupation authorities, particularly the first attack on the shrine at Karbala, which then sparked the uprising by Muqtada al-Sadr. This was, there's a lot of evidence to suggest that this was not actually carried out by Sunni extremists at all, but was carried out by elements connected to the occupation authorities. People say, oh, we don't do things like that. I think after everything that's happened over the last 5 years in Syria, the idea that we, i.e. NATO, the Gulf Cooperation Council, Saudi Arabia, Turkey, we don't do things like that. It's simply not true.
Now, the claims that ISIS
did
this attack in Karbala, killing all these people in the mosque, came announced through something called the AMAQ News Agency, AMAQ News Agency. Now, this is a news outlet, according to the New York Times, and experts, big inverted commas, functions much like an official part of the ISIL media apparatus, although ISIL itself does not acknowledge it as such. It's closely connected with this something called the Site Intelligence Group.
Yeah, well, if you think about ISIS, let's just presume for a moment that ISIS is definitely a creature of, say, the Saudi Arabians. That was shown in the Hillary Clinton email leak from WikiLeaks, definitely supported by the Saudi Arabians. Presumably, to some extent, the Western powers are quite happy for that to happen, but they don't want their fingerprints all over it. Now, the Saudi Arabians have got a vested interest in this because they want to frustrate the Iranians. So, and don't forget that the Iraqi regime, which is largely Shia-dominated, has actually carried out some pretty brutal reprisals against the Sunni population. all of which means that the Shia regime in Iraq is destabilised, which suits the Saudis, and also, of course, the pro-Iranian regime, which Bashar al-Assad is also destabilised in Syria. Now, people who think that we just blunder into these conflicts and then we end up messing it up and they all end up killing each other and we couldn't predict it. Anybody could have predicted that it probably would end in a civil war. But also, of course, our allies are engaged in making a civil war.
OK, but my point about the AMAC news agency, why is it going all around the world that what they're saying is true, that it's this is an ISIS attack, when ISIS themselves have said, actually, we want nothing to do with these AMAC people?
Well, we don't really know who carried out the attack. ISIS, I don't know whether ISIS claimed this responsibility for the attack. It may be that they didn't claim responsibility for the attack and it's being blamed on them. Or they did claim responsibility. Don't forget that ISIS's media operation seems to be run by websites which are like Rita Katz's site website, which is actually based in Langley, Virginia, just down the road from the CIA. And she seems to get all of ISIS's videos as exclusives. And, you know, because her website's called Searching the Internet for terrorist entities, and she gets all of the ISIS exclusives.
Well, hang on a minute, because the IS claimed it carried out the attack in a brief statement put out by its AMAC news agency. Well, that's actually Sky saying it's AMAC news agency, but Sky aren't telling you that actually there's certainly some parts of ISIS that don't actually think that is part of their media.
The question is, who runs ISIS's PR? And the evidence seems to suggest that the PR side of ISIS is very much run by Western intelligence agencies. And this became clear with the White Helmets farrago in eastern Aleppo. Al-Qaeda, which is in control of eastern Aleppo, the White Helmets are embedded with Al-Qaeda, but the White Helmets were themselves set up with British taxpayer money. We were talking about wasting money in the first hour. British taxpayers' money set up the White Helmets through John Le Mesurier, the former British intelligence officer.
It's actually James Le Mesurier.
Yes. But at the same time, they're embedded with Al-Qaeda, who are supposedly our enemies that we've been fighting the last 15 years, and we've killed millions of people to try and defeat. Okay. But in actual fact, we're working with them.
But the point here really is about this whole thing of this, whether was this or was this not really a suicide bombing? First of all, it doesn't seem like there's any kind of corroboration that it was a suicide bombing. Certainly looks like it was a truck, but whether that truck had somebody driving it, whether the person who was driving it knew there was a bomb in the truck, whether it was exploded remotely, is not even discussed. It's just put out as a suicide bombing. So it sounds to me a bit like fake news, and you can see where I'm heading here, that there's just been this whole discussion this week about what's fake news and what isn't fake news. In fact, many of the bulletins running whole items on whether something's fake or not, and, oh, the government's going to have to do something about it. And this is largely started off earlier in the week by Merkel and Obama. They say the internet is a disruptive force that has to be contained, managed and steered by government. Speaking at a joint press conference with outgoing American President Obama at his farewell tour, German Chancellor Angela Merkel made chilling remarks about her views on the need for government to control the internet and slammed anti-Islamization protesters who she accused of hijacking the German spirit of liberty. German Chancellor Merkel is presently deciding whether to run for historic... Well, we know she is actually now going to do that, even though she'll probably lose. She addressed populism in her joint address, calling the surge of interest in right-wing politics a wave that engulfs us. Well, she's just saying that the internet is putting out this right-wing stuff. Well, it certainly may be, but there's all sorts of other views on the internet that are not official government views.
Well, indeed. And in actual fact, what happens when they can't get the results they want by manipulating the media, they then blame the media for not getting the results they want. And of course, there is a lot of disinformation on the internet. There's a lot of disinformation comes from governments as well. And anybody accessing any kind of information,
hearing,
including this show, should check and recheck all the information.
Don't believe a word we say, folks, but yeah. Certainly what we're doing is we're pointing out, for example, there is absolutely no evidence that this truck that killed all these people yesterday is a suicide bombing. Although news is being circulated around the world 20 times for the last couple of days that it was.
Yeah, because what tends to happen is there's also journalists just lazily reinterpreting new events as if they were old events, and you've got psychological warfare officers like John Le Mesurier who is trying to bend our brains
and Rita Katz, for example.
And Rita Katz. Those people, it's called STRATCOM, Strategic Communications. So the purpose of STRATCOM is basically to make people believe what they want you to believe. And they are putting a lot of effort and energy into it. They take your taxes and they sit there trying to bend your mind so that you'll give them more taxes. The white helmets in Syria being a classic example, we're paying for
them. I suppose the idea,
and they're
really,
trying to persuade us that we should do certain things.
I suppose the idea is to sort of mollify people. Say, everything's fine. It's okay. Your government's not corrupt. It's not lying to you. It's not supporting terrorists, etc. But anyway, Labour's fake news crusader, Mike Duggar, wrote for The Sun and quaffed champagne and oysters with Murdoch, Evolve Politics tells us this week. The deputy leader of the Labour Party, Tom Watson, has tasked fellow Labour MP Mike Duggar to head an inquiry into fake news on social media, BuzzFeed News reports. Project hopes to tackle fake news stories created for profit and purposefully fake stories published in order to discredit political opponents. Watson elaborated further, claiming that it can be tempting to share a meme showing what the mainstream media won't tell you. But sometimes the much-derided mainstream media won't tell you something because it checked it out and it wasn't true. That's why we need good journalists and good journalism. I've never been afraid to take on the mainstream media when it abuses its power or acts illegally or unethically by hacking phones, bribing public officials or going through people's bins, and complaints about the biased mainstream media are sometimes justified, but the solution does not lie in the creation of this form of pseudo-journalism, says Tom Watson.
Well, the fact of the matter is, it's caveat emptor, but let the buyer beware. Anybody can lie to you, governments lie to you, corporations lie to you, and people on them. We could be lying on this programme, although obviously we try not to, you know, you've got to take our word for it, but you have got to check for yourself. And of course, there's actually what the fact of the matter is that governments pay an awful lot of money to people to work on both social media and in the mainstream media to tell us lies, like, for example, that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction, which now everybody accepts was a total untruth, a deliberate lie. And everybody involved in that deliberate lie lied to us.
Well,
but
the people
they weren't on social media.
The people that tried to tell the truth, like Greg Dyke and Andrew Gilligan, were sacked.
Indeed. So what the problem we've got
the
here...
The same thing is true in a more recent case, actually, with the Jimmy Savile situation. Yep. All of the reporters at Newsnight that tried to get the report out about Jimmy Savile and were stopped on Newsnight, they've all been pushed out of their jobs.
That's right. So what we've got now is an information war in which your mind is the battlefield. And everybody's got to recognise that that's what's going on. Now, the internet has got many faults about it, but one of the beautiful things about it is that, and it should be standard practice, and you will see on our show page later, that there will be plenty of links for you to check whether what we have said is true or not. What you find in mainstream media is that they give you a general impression of what they want. This fake news meme is a meme. It's been created. It's an idea that we can discredit all of these people who, for example, like Donald Trump, like Alex Jones, who supported Donald Trump. They said that they were not happy with the 9/11 attacks. They thought it might be an inside job. I don't suppose Donald is saying much about that at the moment, but that's what he used to say. Now, in actual fact, he's probably right about that, and I'm not a Trump voter. That's the sort of thing they want to squash. They want to squash the fact that the white helmets are in fact supported by the British government, by NATO, by their NATO allies, and they're embedded with Al-Qaeda.
Anyway, this chap Michael Duggar, who Tom Watson has picked, is vehemently anti-Corbyn to do this inquiry into fake news for the Labour Party. He's a columnist a columnist for The Sun. And he's very friendly with Rupert Murdoch.
I mean, and the point is that they're engaged
maybe
in faking
getting
news
worried.
Themselves.
Maybe Murdoch is getting worried that people just don't believe this mainstream media anymore.
Well, that's one of the problems they've got. In the past, if they wanted to achieve a certain goal, like we're going to war with Syria, all they had to do was control certain newsrooms, certain editors, and then that's the only story people would hear. Nowadays, people can look it up for themselves. They can look up for themselves, for example, Donald Trump's comments about 9/11, immediately after 9/11, when he said, I build these buildings. He doesn't really build them, he pays for them to be built, and they don't collapse like that. This is a load of rubbish. And of course, he was right about that, and he's now president-elect. I hope he's going to do something about 9/11. What do you think, Tony?
Well, it is a bit of a weird one, this whole thing about fake news, because, of course, you do want freedom of the press, but then you don't want the whole of the London media to be saying the same thing. And, of course, when they're taking much of their copy from the wire services, the Press Association, Associated Press, Reuters, and they're just cutting and pasting it into our newspapers, of course, you know, all you need to do is to get at those wire services. And we've pointed out several times on this programme that most of those wire services are paid for by the stock exchange money that they're data that they do, that they distribute. For example, you know, people like Bloomberg, another news service, but most of the money for Bloomberg, same with Reuters, comes from just distributing figures to do with stock markets, and that's where they're funded from. So how can you guarantee that what they're saying is true? I mean, you simply can't. A very good article, actually, I found on this one is by Robert Parry this week on the Consortium News website. He says, what to do about, big inverted commas, fake news? A pushback is coming, he says, to the internet's success in giving the world access to diverse opinions and dissenting information. Politics, mainstream media and technology giants are taking aim at what they call fake news. In the wake of Donald Trump's victory, raised by President Obama in an international setting on Thursday last week, touted in the New York Times front page on Friday last week, is the problem of fake news being disseminated over the internet. Companies like Google and Facebook are being urged to censor such articles to punish alleged violators. I mean, one of the people behind this is Google News Labs, formed in June 2015 and funded by Google News Labs, the First Draft Coalition, they call themselves. The founding members included, and these are supposedly guaranteed true news, yeah, not fake news, included Bellingcat, an online citizen journalist that has got many of its highest profile stories wrong and is now associated with NATO's favourite think tank, the Atlantic Council. Despite Bellingcat's checkered record and its conflicts of interest, Elliot Higgins, I think, is the guy that runs it, through the Atlantic Council, major Western news outlets, including the New York Times and Washington Post, embraced him, apparently because its articles always seem to mesh neatly with US and European propaganda on Syria and Ukraine. Two of Bellingcat's biggest errors were misplacing the firing location of the suspected Syrian rocket carrying sarin gas on August the 21st, 2013, and directing an Australian news crew to the wrong site of the so-called getaway book missile video after the July the 17th, 2014 shoot down of Malaysian Airlines Flight 17. So what they're saying here is that the really good internet news sites are the ones that support NATO, and actually this Bellingcat guy has been just peddling propaganda.
And of course, the internet being what it is, and we'll be on the internet later with this show, is that we can unpick that and we can point out that they're lying to you. So what you've got is a wall of lies coming from mainstream media to selected social media activists. Don't forget, the Israelis have got lots and lots of students, for example, paid to sit there, sitting on internet chat rooms, pushing certain lines. So nothing is to be taken for granted. Absolutely nothing. Bellingcat, in fact, was just set up by a guy in Britain who was made redundant, supposedly, and then suddenly made himself an expert on weaponry, even though he got no background in it. The Syrian Observatory for Human Rights is one guy based in a flat in Coventry. These people are, in fact, now being funded by NATO intelligence services, but they're presented to us as if they're independent sources. They're not.
Also, I mean, Robert Parry, who's he, the guy that wrote this article for Consortium News? Well, he's lost his job at Associated Press, but he's an investigative reporter. He broke many of the Iran-Contra stories for the Associated Press back when it told the truth, and in Newsweek in the 1980s. You can buy his latest book, it says here, on this article on Consortium News, and the book's called America's Stolen Narrative, either in print or as an e-book, and I'll put a link to that on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. Also, one of the other things he looks at in this article is the attack, as he puts it, on Russia Today and on Russian journalists. A new alarm about fake news, he says, comes amid the US government's information war against Russia regarding the Syrian and Ukraine conflicts. Obama's State Department insists it is presenting the truth about these conflicts, while Russia's RT channel is a font of disinformation.
Well, as a frequent contributor to Russia Today, I would suggest that their standards of what they're prepared to put out and what they're not prepared to put out are actually higher than most of the Western press, including the BBC. And what you'll find, in fact, is that they're prepared to have various voices. So you'll find Donald Trump and Nigel Farage and George Galloway on RT. You won't find any of them on the BBC in the same way.
An RT journalist asked the State Department spokesperson, Mr. Kirby, to identify hospitals and clinics in Syria that he claimed had been hit by Russian and Syrian airstrikes. You might assume that a truth teller would have welcomed the opportunity to provide more details. That could then be checked and verified. But in Instead, Kirby berated the RT journalist and tried to turn the rest of the State Department press corps against her. Question, do you think that it is important to give a specific list of hospitals that you're accusing Russia of hitting? These are grave accusations. Then Kirby replies, I'm not making those accusations. I'm telling you, we've seen reports from credible organisations that five hospitals and a clinic have been hit.
Well, there has been pointed out on the internet and on RT, the last hospital in Aleppo and the last paediatrician in Aleppo have died several times. You can tell when people are lying, when there's actually inconsistency in what, they, in what they're
but
actually
Martin,
saying.
But Martin, hardly any of
you
us, have got,
know anymore,
any of us have got the time to keep track of all of this. We just expect we're not being lied to.
No. So what people do, if they haven't got a lot of time to follow the news, is they'll switch on one regarded news source once a day and they'll try and get the info from that. Well, but what's happening in international affairs is that the RT in English is actually outpacing the competition because people all over the world realise that they've got a more objective view from them than they're getting from CNN, Fox, etc. Now, in actual fact, that's a competition and they're going to lose it.
On a related topic, a witch hunt report urges UK to map, challenge and expose public figures with Russia links. This is on Russia Today. An influential right-wing think tank has proposed a radical clampdown on politicians and other prominent figures sympathetic to Russia by challenging their credibility, revealing their insidious means of funding and forcing them to reveal if they receive money for appearing on RT. A new report published by the Henry Jackson Society comes up as the EU Parliament prepares to debate how to resist disinformation and propaganda from Russia, called Putin's Useful Idiots. The 17-page document was written by Andrew Foxhall, director of the Russia Studies Centre at the Conservative think tank. Foxhall said that Putin makes for a deceptive and dangerous friend for those on the left who can be relied on to stand up for the West's enemies, whoever and wherever they may be.
Well, that probably includes me. I am paid when I appear on Russia Today. I'm paid £50 every time I appear. So let's put that on the table. Now, what was the name of that chap you just mentioned? Could you tell his name again?
Now you're asking, aren't you? Yeah, okay, go on.
Well, the point is, I'd like to know where his money comes from.
Andrew Foxhall. F-O-X-A-L-L.
Right. I've just said on air, I get £50 every time I appear on Russia Today. Where does Andrew Foxhall's money come from? I want to know all of it. Every bit of it.
Good question. So anyway, it seems as if that they're trying to really just sort of take out and take down people who are supporting Russia in any way in the Western media. I suppose that's maybe because they're being blocked militarily. They're now focusing, the eye of Sauron is focusing on back on the domestic
situation. Well, you know
what situation.
It is? I didn't do an appearance on RT last week because I just couldn't do it about this exact topic. And what I would have said is they're rattled. They're rattled because RT, in fact, is taking their audience. And RT is taking their audience in the same way that BBC took the Nazis' audience in World War II. They are more reliable, and people know they're more reliable. And as long as they stick to their guns, inverted commas, and don't go for outright propaganda, but just expose the lies that the West is telling, they will carry on winning, because the West thinks that they can lie and get away with it,
but
they can't.
But one thing they don't do is criticise Putin, do they? But, you know, that's the Russia Today should be doing that. If they
well, we could argue that. I mean, I think Putin was involved in the bombings in Moscow in 1999. But
it doesn't matter, does it? I mean, even in the day-to-day
but
things...
But he was working with
example,
the Western intelligence services at the time.
For example, the Russian Communist Party is the main opposition. I can remember when I went on Russia Today a couple of years ago talking about the death of Boris Nemtsov, when Russia Today put that YouTube clip up, they edited out any reference to the Communist Party, so they don't like the world to know that there's actually a very strong Communist Party, and it's probably the biggest opposition party in the whole of Russia.
Yeah, far bigger than the Western, like them Pussy Riot and their allies.
So they're all at it. Is what I'm saying.
Support of the
is what I'm saying is they're all at it. Do you think there's any evidence that the West is any worse than the Russians at this?
I think they are. Yes, I think that there is clear evidence. For example, if we look at Syria for instance, the Ghouta chemical weapons attack not only was not carried out by Assad, according to Seymour Hersh, who is an extremely credible journalist of the old school, it was actually carried out by the rebels with sarin supplied from Libya by NATO intelligence services. So when it was a red line that something had to be done, including full all-out war, because chemical weapons were being used, we were basically pointing the finger at ourselves. So in other words, we should have gone to war with Turkey. But then, of course, we'd have to go to war with Turkey's allies. That's us. And maybe the Syrians should have executed some British intelligence officers in London as a reprisal. I wouldn't advise that they should have done that, but they might. and it would have been absolutely justified by the West's own admission.
Okay, a top scientist who discovered the Alexander Litvinenko poison was stabbed himself to death with two knives after a trip to Russia, we hear this week. This is from The Mirror. The father of two reportedly died from self-inflicted injuries, despite one detective believing he couldn't have stayed conscious long enough to wound himself that much. The radiation expert who discovered the poison that killed Alexander Litvinenko, he committed suicide, apparently by stabbing himself repeatedly with two knives months after a trip to Russia. A coroner has ruled Matthew Puncher, 46, bled to death at his home after receiving multiple stab wounds across his body from two kitchen knives. The inquest heard a pathologist said he could not completely exclude the possibility that someone else had been involved.
Where did this take place, Tony?
In the UK.
In the UK.
He is an expert in radiation protection dosimetry and worked for the Public Health England and the UK's Atomic Energy Research Establishment at Harwell in Oxfordshire.
Well, one of the things that hasn't been really highlighted in the Western media is that the polonium trail, because they found polonium all over the place after Litvinenko died, they found some at Berezovsky's office, who was one of the allies of Litvinenko, and in actual fact had something to gain by killing Litvinenko, because he wanted to create an incident of hostility between Russia and the West. Now, it's possible that this guy knows too much, but he wouldn't necessarily have been killed by the Russians. And that's not to say that the Russians aren't capable of carrying out these kind of acts. They probably are, but then so are our own lot. And the question is, what happened in each individual case?
I mean, I just described this online last night as more of a silo of snakes than a can of worms, this case, because it's absolutely enormous, isn't it? It goes right the way back to how Putin came to power.
It does. It does go. And it's extraordinary that of all of the things that they throw at Putin, they don't throw at him that he may have been involved in the bombings in Moscow and Ryazan in 1998. And you know why that is? Because at that stage, he was an ally of Berezovsky, who was working with the Western intelligence services to frustrate the electoral victory, which was looking on the cards, for Zyuganov, who was the head of the Russian Communist Party. And Zyuganov is still the head of the Russian Communist Party. And he's a critical supporter of Putin's foreign policy. But the whole thing was directed at him. Now, strangely enough, Berezovsky was pushing for them to go on about how Putin had been involved in bombing Moscow and Ryazan in 1998. Because he knew that Putin was involved in it, because he helped Putin to plan it.
Well,
but at the same time, of course, that was opened a whole can of worms, because that was all done with the knowledge of the Western intelligence services, because they wanted to stop the communists winning the election.
Let's see if we can avenge the death a little of Matthew Puncher, who clearly didn't stab himself with two knives.
Any more than Gary Webb shot himself in the head with two bullets when he exposed the Iran-Contra affair in the 1980s.
By looking at Putin's ride to power, because this is what the key thing about Litvinenko is, he wrote this book, didn't he, Blowing Up Russia, about Putin's rise to power, and it is absolutely fascinating reading. Also quite a lot of internet documentaries, and when I get back home this evening, I'll put a link to one of the best ones of them, and this was the Russian NTV, which was the first independent television station to open up after 1990.
It was owned by Berezovsky.
Yes, it was owned by Berezovsky, but it was all about that bomb attack. And what they did, it's a fascinating bit of footage, is where they actually got in the studio loads of residents from the housing estate where these bombs were found, along with some of the chiefs of the local police and the secret police, the FSB, from Moscow in the studio at the same time. And it's absolutely incredible to see the locals challenging these Secret Service chiefs over basically calling them out as liars.
Well, what happened was that the local police arrested two guys, and they found and they checked the hold all, they were carrying a bomb, and it turned out they were FSB. The bomb in that case didn't go off. But of course the suspicion was that it was blamed on the Chechens, but it was actually carried out by the FSB. And the reason, that the motive for this was because the communists were going to win the election. Don't forget that the people's living standards had collapsed because of the Thatcherite policies that had been pursued and so on.
And if you go down the rabbit hole a little further, we find the figure of Vladimir Putin actually helping to cover up that bomb attack and then being trusted by Berezovsky.
Indeed.
And actually maybe, a little bit later, turning the tables on Berezovsky.
Well, what was bizarre about Berezovsky, he knew that he and Putin, because Berezovsky was the head of the oligarchs, he was the chief oligarch, he ran NTV.
And also they were taking over loads and loads of public...
They basically stole the public sector in Russia, was stolen by them, and they made a lot of money out of it. But of course the effects on ordinary people have been absolutely dramatically bad, and by 1998 they were ready to vote for the communists. The opinion polls showed, and it happened elsewhere in Eastern Europe. Europe as well. Even in Poland, where I used to live, the Communist Party won the second election. And they won the second election in virtually every East European country once people had a good dose of Thatcherism rammed down their throats. So it was perfectly feasible and natural for the Russians to vote for the Communists. But that wouldn't have been acceptable to the oligarchy in Russia, and it wasn't acceptable to the Western powers. So they cooked up the whole thing, and Berezovsky had links with the Chechen rebels, including Dudayev, who then invaded Dagestan, I think it was, even though they'd already won their independence. There was no reason for them to do that, and there was no reason for them to bomb Moscow either. They'd already won their independence. There was no reason for them to do any of it. The point was that then Putin, as a sort of a man on a white horse, rides in and saves the day. But of course, Putin, having saved the day for the oligarchy, then said, right, you owe me, you lot. I am now going to discipline
and
you.
In fact,
that's what he did.
In fact, what he said, wasn't it, to Berezovsky, is you've got 24 hours to leave the country, otherwise you're
going
to
be arrested. Well, they fell out. Berezovsky recruited Putin and spoke to Yeltsin and said, look, we need Putin to
So Berezovsky was hoping that Putin was going to be his puppet as a president.
Yep. But he wasn't.
An interesting, fascinating story. And let's hope there's no more deaths involved with this, because it's absolutely horrendous that someone should die such
a hideous interesting
death.
To me about it is that, in actual fact, the evidence suggests that Litvinenko may not have been killed by the Russians. My money is on Berezovsky's people killing him, because they needed a further incident between Russia and the West so that they could then push for Berezovsky to replace Putin. Berezovsky's aspiration was to replace Putin as leader of Russia.
You see, people think you can't get to the bottom of this stuff, but I think you can, and I'm going to put up a couple of links for folks that are a bit sceptical about this on the show page at thisweek.org.uk tonight, hopefully to show that you can actually open up that silo full of snakes and find out what really happened.
Getting bigger by being better. The number one choice for Bristol. This is BCFM 93.2.
Now we're looking at the money system tonight, Martin. We've had the autumn statement. We keep hearing there's not enough money for this, not enough money for that, particularly things like the basic things we need, like the health service, for social care, this kind of thing, for disability benefits, for unemployment benefits. In Scotland, some good signs that maybe there's a basic system where people will have enough money so that they can have somewhere to live, have something to eat, and some of the basics in life, which are being taken away from us here in England. But Martin, ultimately, of course, the problem is not being solved at all by Philip Hammond today, nor by John McDonnell, because the real problem is that the government, actually, if they wish to, they could be taking a much stronger line, couldn't they? They could be actually printing money themselves if they wanted. They don't have to go totally cap in hand to the private banks to get this money to borrow it.
No, and I think Andy Haldane from the Bank of England has suggested, and Mervyn King was suggesting, well, perhaps we ought to think about the government creating the money supply. People don't realise this, but the money supply is actually in the hands of the private sector.
A lot of people are thinking about it. There's Positive Money, for example, that have been talking about this. Let's do it. We don't have to suffer. Why is this system like it is?
Well, two reasons. Because there's inertia. You know, we do it like this because we've always done it like this, and to change it would just be change, and we don't like change. And also because there's vested interests that the private banking sector does not want to lose that very powerful position that they have of creating
the
money
supply. I suppose they have their own kind of form of feudal sort of political patronage where they give money to the people that they want you can borrow it and you can't. And also, of course, the bank at the end of the day could say, okay, well, we just lost some money there, we'll just write it off.
Well, yeah, but the point is that they're able basically to act as a parasitic worm in the system, as it were. Because they create the money supply, they're able to siphon it off in their direction. If the government was in that position, they could siphon off the money in their direction, and that would then be the money that you could use to fund the various things that governments do. You could have something like land value taxation, for example, which would take the increase in value of land and use that to fund things that people
do. I would totally disagree with that.
I know we don't agree about that.
I think we don't agree about that. Let me put my case. I mean, you've put your case there. But my case against that is that you should be taxing things which are luxuries, not which are fundamental needs and fundamental rights.
I'm talking about the unimproved value of land, Tony. In other words, essentially land nationalisation.
I don't think you should have to pay anything. For example, a gypsy or a traveller should have to pay a penny for the land that they're on.
That's another story.
Or a householder, actually. I think maybe the people who are wealthy.
Well, I'm sorry I brought it up because we don't agree about that, but we certainly do agree about positive money.
Anyway, there is this kind of credit system we're moving towards, away from cash, more and more on our chip and PIN cards, contactless payment cards on a microchip, which is a credit system where the bank, you don't actually have anything of value yourself. You're totally reliant on the bank. And of course, at some point, the bank might just switch you off.
Well, what's happened in India recently is the Narendra Modi government has taken out out of circulation big notes, which has caused all kinds of problems on a practical level, and he said it's an anti-corruption measure. But ultimately what you're doing is you're trying to make increased control by the private banking system over people's lives. So, for example, if you want to get, when there's a banking crash and you go and try and take your money out in cash, they'll say, well, we don't do cash. You can't take your money out of our system.
Everyone is being persuaded to get rid of cash, but actually cash is the only thing that has got some sort of, I mean, even if it's a tiny amount of metal intrinsic worth. The idea is that the infrastructure, that is to say the cash points, the Bank of England, the banks are in complete command of the system, and you're just sitting there sort of hanging on a web.
They're being forced into this cashless economy because they're trying to get negative interest rates going. That's the only way they can keep the system going, is to have negative interest rates. But of course, if you have negative interest rates, you're asking for a bank run. But if nobody could get their money out in cash because there isn't any cash, then you have to keep your money in the bank, even if it's losing value, because there's nowhere else for you to put it.
Well, I think the banks come in, the banksters are coming weekly for criticism on this programme. But going back to World War II, we've done quite a lot on Desmond Morton, who was Major Desmond Morton. He was actually in charge of economic warfare between the wars. Then he became Churchill's personal sort of intelligence secretary afterwards. But this whole idea of banks actually being able to sort of replace the military in a domestic and a civil and civilian way. So you can get taken over by a tank during the war. A tank might come crashing through your building or shoot you or whatever. Nowadays, banks can take over just as effectively with money. They can take over your business and you then have to leave, and then they run it and own it. So in a way, banks are like tanks, aren't they?
Well, yes. I mean, all but the money system and the system of violence are both methods of political power, of getting what you want, of making people do what you want them to do. As I've said on this show for several weeks running, our current policy in Britain and the European Union is to bankrupt the Russian economy. That's our goal. We want the Russian economy to scream, because the hope is that the poor people in Russia who lose their jobs or whatever as a result of the crash of the economy will turn on their government. There's no real evidence that that's going to happen, or even that we're going to be able to crash their economy. But even if we were to crash the Russian economy, we would just end up in the situation that we were in 1998, when the Russian economy crashed and therefore nearly brought down the Western banking system with it through the collapse of long-term capital management, because everything's connected to everything else.
Now, one of the first things that I came across, which started explaining a bit of this to me, and I put a link up to this on our show page too, is a documentary by a former Canadian mainstream journalist, used to work for CBC, I believe, in Canada, Daniel Hopsicker. He did a film a few years ago called The Federal Reserve. And he called them the masters of the universe. Here's a little clip from that now.
Thomas Jefferson wrote, "If the American people ever allow the banks to control the issuance of their currency, first by inflation and then by deflation, the banks and corporations that will grow up around them will deprive the people of all property until their children will wake up homeless on the continents their fathers occupied."
See, what the Federal Reserve Act of 1913 did was give this private banking cartel total monopoly of printing money. So what you had here was a complete takeover of the government of the United States by these private bankers. They've owned it ever since.
100 years after Jefferson, Abraham Lincoln was pondering the same issues when he said, "The government should create, issue, and circulate all the currency. Creating and issuing money is the supreme prerogative of government and its greatest creative opportunity. Adopting these principles will save the taxpayers immense sums of interest, and money will cease to be the master and become the servant of humanity."
Every $100 bill which the Federal Reserve System prints and is sold to the United States at full face value represents a $100 loan. Even though the government pays for it, they still pay interest, and it becomes, that's what your $4 trillion debt is, are the Federal Reserve notes.
What do the fears expressed by Jefferson and Lincoln have to do with today's murmurings about something called the New World Order?
And incidentally, it was Woodrow Wilson who first proclaimed the New World Order.
It was the creation of the Federal Reserve that put the cap on this whole revolution, because that's what it was.
Well, some revolution, certainly not for the people. But anyhow, another interesting person who's looked into this is Bill Steele. And here's a clip here from his film, The Secret of Oz, talking about really the money system being the biggest heist ever perpetrated on humanity.
Fundamentally, there's a problem with banking, and that is that bankers lend out money that they don't actually have. How did that come about historically?
It's a great gig if you can get it. If you or I actually lent money at interest that we didn't have, I believe that's called counterfeiting or fraud or both, and we'd be immediately thrown into jail. But when you're a banker and you can do it, you can get away with it. And, of course, it's in the banker's interest to try to keep the politicians from making that a crime. And that's exactly what they've been able to successfully do. So we have a two-pronged problem. That is, we have nations borrowing money. That's a problem that has to be fixed. And we have banks lending money that they don't actually have. If you fixed those two problems, then you fix the economic system. And nothing else will fix the economic system. Until we address those problems, this is going to go nowhere but down, I can assure you.
Well, obviously, I agree with everything that's being said about positive money, but I think there's a tendency to see everything as coming just from one source. It's one of the means of oppression. Economic warfare certainly exists and is certainly used. Ordinary warfare also exists. Intelligence warfare also exists. There are various mechanisms by which people are oppressed.
So, Martin, let's cut to the chase here. What about 2008? Because that was a massive bailout when these banks should have failed. Ultimately, what it's meant is that we've been kicked into a situation where we've got a massive amount of national debt, rather like the United States, which is never going to be paid back. So where is this all heading?
Well, it's heading towards a crash, as I've said week in, week out. And everybody says, oh, well, it hasn't crashed yet.
But what's happening in the meantime? What's happening in the meantime, it seems, is the whole of society is having to work harder and harder and harder, apart from the richest of the rich, for less and less money. And also the bills are gradually going up too. So you've got less and less disposable income. Many people, of course, with zero or negative disposable
income. Well, this is a fundamental problem for the capitalist system, because by various mechanisms they want to drive down the value of labour.
So is it fair to say, as I said at the top of the hour, that capitalism is dead after 2008?
Well, it's traditional capitalism as understood in the textbooks, whereby if you lose money eventually you go bust and somebody else takes over because you're inefficient, certainly. Because the bailout by the government of the failed banking system was a definitive repudiation of all the textbooks about if you make a loss, you go bust. Now, the reason why governments were bounced into doing it, because the alternative was a crash. Now, the problem with a crash is that the real free marketeers, the von Mises Institute, the Austrian school, they think that a crash should have just been allowed to happen. Because they believe if you have a crash, capitalism is a natural system, we're all naturally capitalist, and capitalism will spontaneously regenerate from the crash. I'm a socialist, I don't believe that. When you have a crash, society fractures. You then have civil wars, you then have huge problems, and you don't necessarily get a wonderful capitalist solution just appearing out of nowhere.
Rebooting the system as or before it's crashing?
Well, what you should have done is you bail the banks out and then you take them over. But that means you've got to have some plan for what you want to do with them when you take them over. I mean, the Labour Party ended up in government controlling the banking system, which was one of the goals of the 1918 Clause 4. But they finally reached the goal and they just freaked out completely and tried to walk away from it because they didn't know what to do with it when it appeared as a baby on the, in their arms.
Gordon Brown and Alistair Darling didn't have the skill set to deal with, to actually do the stuff.
Well,
they
had no idea that such a thing could happen, which just shows how far away they'd got from basic labour values and labour analysis.
So
they'd given up on analysing capitalism. They just presumed capitalism looked after itself, which it patently didn't do.
Of course not. No, so is 2008 the biggest heist in history? Has this ever happened before?
No. It's an enormous change, but the next crash is going to make 2008 look like a walk in the park, because now we've committed the resources of the governments all over the world to propping the system up, which wasn't the case in 2008. And when it crashes next time, there will be no money apart from in the bank accounts of the super wealthy, and they've basically stolen it, so we'll have to take it back off them by force, probably.
Now, you brought up World War II briefly there. I mentioned Desmond Morton, this dodgy figure who was doing deals with the Nazis behind the back of everybody at the end of the Second World War. What about Montague Norman? He's an interesting figure as well. He was a governor of the Bank of England, but he was actually having quite close relations with some of the Nazis too.
Well, he was personal friend of Haldimar Schacht, who was the who was Hitler's finance chief. And the Bank of International Settlements had been set up to administer the reparations regime that had been imposed on Germany at the end of World War I. The
Treaty of Versailles.
Yeah, well, yes, but I mean, if you think about it, the Germans were being made to pay for the World War as if they were 100% responsible for it. Only them, just them, nobody else. In actual fact, I think if you're objective about it, you would argue that, you know, the blame for World War One should be placed, you know, fairly in various places. And the idea of punishing the Germans was idiotic. But of course, that led to various problems, which led to World War Two, as we know. But behind all of this is the manipulation of war and peace by people with money.
Okay, is it all bluster? Will HSBC leave?
Leave when?
London.
Because of Brexit?
Well, for whatever reason. I mean, just they're threatening, aren't they, to go?
Well, I think what will happen before any of Brexit comes, you know, Brexit's going to take years to unravel, but in actual fact, the banks are going to crash long before Brexit actually takes place, in my view.
But they're not going to, government's not going to allow them to, surely. I mean, they're going to threaten again.
The next time when the banks crash, the government will not be in a position to stop because they're already, they've already shot their bolt. So next time, it really will go down. And then we will have the cataclysmic crash that we avoided.
And
with all of
the national debt is like this kind of 100-ton weight hanging over the nation that none of the Westminster politicians seem to want to deal with.
Can I also just add, it's the debt of the private sector corporations which is hanging over us as well. People go on about government debt, government. Government can print their own money if they wanted to, as you've pointed out. Private corporations are massively in debt so that they can buy their own shares back, so that the shareholders and the people in charge of those corporations can make themselves fantastically wealthy as in a parasitic way. The way our corporations function by using debt in that way is the fundamental problem. The government can be sorted. That can't.
We also had a terrific interview, didn't we, with Steve Keen, the economist who's got some really good answers to a lot of this, and he wrote the book Debunking Economics, and he was at a conference, I noticed, at the end of the beginning of this week. So I'll put some links up to his material on this, which is really all to do with the greatest heist in history and the death of capitalism.
Getting bigger by being better. The number one choice for Bristol. This is BCFM 93.2.
So we're going to have a listen now to Anthony Hall. He's Professor Anthony Hall, who was suspended from his job at a university in Alberta in Canada, although he's actually one of the best authors, writers and professors writing about the September the 11th attacks, what really happened, and the way it's been used to bamboozle really most of the Western world, although most of the rest of the world doesn't really believe it. We are supposed to, through our media, to justify wars like the invasion of Iraq, etc., etc. So anyway, let's listen to see what he's got to say here, because this is a clip I heard of his, Martin, and we'll have a chat about it afterwards, which I thought was fascinating about the way that the mission accomplished in Iraq ceremony was conducted on TV by the media, and also, of course, in the centre stage on an aircraft carrier, there sits George W. Bush.
I saw this amazing ceremony, mission accomplished, recall that, on the Abraham Lincoln. And it wasn't accidental that it took place on the Abraham Lincoln, because when I went through the script, there was a reference to releasing the Iraqis from enslavement. There was a reference to the Gettysburg Address by the Iraqis, for the Iraqis, of the Iraqis. So this was a PSYOP. This was an advertising campaign for the military-industrial complex, actually comparing the invasion of Iraq and the subsequent illegal occupation to the freeing of the slaves, to Abraham Lincoln's freeing of the slaves. Remember, George Bush landed on the Abraham Lincoln on the deck, very much like Triumph of the Will begins with Adolf Hitler. coming down from the skies to the Nuremberg rally in 1934, very much like the film Independence Day, where the President of the United States is actually in a jet fighter plane opposing the aliens. And it became increasingly clear to me that this was not accidental, this was not coincidental, this was a highly manufactured piece of military propaganda, and they were drawing on the masters of propaganda in Hollywood, in Nuremberg. And that's going to be the subject tonight that I want to deal with, the nature of the PSYOP that we're dealing with, the psychological operation. And of course, that is the deepest sort of science and technology of this country, going back to Edward Bernays, the Crook Commission, studying how you affect public opinion, how you advertise, you know, not only products, but presidents, political campaigns. And of course, we know that war is the most lucrative contract for the Madison Avenue so-called PR companies, which are really propaganda companies. Edward Bernays, who was the nephew of Sigmund Freud and a student of the subconscious and the manipulation of public opinion, after Goebbels liked his book, and Goebbels was the minister of propaganda, he came up with this term, public relations. Much of the crimes of our time take place in these public relations agencies, where today, I'm sure, you know, how many billions went out to public relations agencies for the events today to plant in our minds this fear of Arab and Muslim people, this poison, toxic mind pollution that causes hatred among ourselves, that gives justification to the war machine, that so that when you blast in white phosphorus, depleted uranium, to destroy whole populations, genetic, constitution forever, for all times. When you send in drones, the robotic madness and corruption and horrible, the idea that that nobody actually is taking direct responsibility. It's all being done by robots. So, you know, the robotization of the military in the United States, a huge implications around that. None of this could happen if you didn't dehumanize the populations, the children, the women, the elders, the civilians who are receiving this destruction. So we know with the Reichstag fire, we can look back at the Holocaust. We can see the propaganda techniques to dehumanize Jews, to prepare for that horrific event we call the Holocaust.
That's Professor Anthony Hall there talking about the sort of psychological ramifications of the announcement of the end of the war in Iraq, Martin. But it's a massive psychological element here. A lot of this seems to be a news program, but actually someone has sat there and scripted it all out beforehand, someone from the military.
Yes, indeed. And of course, with all the years of hindsight we've got now, it certainly wasn't mission accomplished, was it? It was just setting the road onto the bigger war that we're now on the verge of. So that wasn't such a clever move at all.
There is surely some good signs in the US. For example, the CIA guy, I'm just trying to remember his name, that Mike Pompeo, that Trump is going to be bringing in January, seems to be a lot more sensible than the previous CIA people, a lot of the intelligence people.
No, not at all. Pompeo is a hardliner. He's a nutcase. And Michael Flynn, who we mentioned last week, his only positive thing is that he sees that war with Russia is insane. But of course, in actual fact, he's actually on in every other
nutcase. Next week, we'll have a look at Pompeo, see what he's got to say. Anyway, time to sign off for the Murdoch News at 7 now. Coming up, Arabian Nights with Mohammed Makawi. Thanks to our guest in the first hour, Lib Dem Councillor for Hengrove and Whitchurch Park, Tim Kent. To Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers, of course. Our sister show Dialects at noon every Tuesday. Our show page for your comments, one word, is thisweek.org.uk. I'm on Twitter at Tony Gosling. I'm wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. Do please join us for the politics show at the same time next week. God bless. And don't let the banksters get you down.
Pacifica Radio, this is Voices of the Middle East and North Africa. I am Maliher Azazan.
And I'm Khalil Bendib. What is the power of music? And how does it help children to cope with the harsh daily realities of living and growing up under military occupation?
I mean, Shahada saw his one of his best friends shot dead when they went to try to escape the curfew, break the curfew to get bread, and his best friend was shot and killed right beside him. And this family was very traumatized during the Second Intifada. So Rasha and Allah reported that there was a sense of protection they felt from the music. And Rasha herself, according to many people I talked to, went from a very angry, traumatized child to this self-respecting young woman and musician.
We'll speak with veteran journalist and professor of communication and journalism at the University of Southern California, Sandy Tolan, about his new book, Children of the Stone, The Power of Music in a Hard Land. The book tells the story of Palestinian musician Ramzi Hussein Abu Radwan and his music school, Al-Qamanjati, Arabic for the violinist, as well as the intersection of music and resistance. Later in the program, war journalist Anna Batkin takes us to Afghanistan in her book, The World is a Carpet, Four Seasons in an Afghan Village, to tell the story of ordinary Afghans who have endured decades of wars and occupation. All this coming up on Voices of the Middle East and North Africa. Stay with us. What is the power of music and how does it inspire and transform the daily lives of the Palestinians living under occupation? USC communication professor and journalist Sandy Tolan's new book, Children of the Stone, The Power of Music in a Hard Land, tells the story of Ramzi Hussein Abu Radwan, a child of the first Palestinian Intifada, whose Al-Qamanjati Music Center teaches hundreds of Palestinian children in the occupied West Bank and refugee camps in Lebanon. Sandy Tolan told Malihi about where he first met Ramzi.
Well, it was actually around the time that I was doing research for what first was a radio documentary and then a book, The Lemon Tree, and it was 1998. And I saw these posters all over Ramallah of this little boy. Two pictures on the poster. One was a photograph of a little boy, 8 years old, throwing a stone in the first Palestinian Intifada in late 1987, early 88. And then juxtaposed with that was the same boy, except for he was now 18 and he was playing the viola. And beneath that it said, the Palestine National Conservatory of Music. Mm-hmm. It was an advertisement for the conservatory, but also, in a sense, for the notion of Palestinian freedom and independence. And that, at that time, although a lot of people were skeptical, most of the hopes around that time centered around the notion of a two-state solution, that it was really possible. People thought it was going to happen. And there was a lot of hope in the air. And so at that point, you know, I kept seeing these posters everywhere and then met Ramzi. I went with my wife at the time as a Palestinian journalist, and we went into Al-Amari refugee camp, and I just spent a lot of time with him. And what I remember most of all him saying is, you know, I asked him what his dream was, and he was a kid from the camps. He was raised by his impoverished grandparents, and he said, you know, my dream is to play in the first national symphony of Palestine, and my dream is to open up music schools all over Palestine so that children know there's something besides a stone.
How old was he back then?
He was 18. And I thought, you know, this is a beautiful dream for a kid who was raised in a refugee camp. But sure enough, he then gets a scholarship to study in France, study the viola. And I kept in touch with him for a couple of years and then lost track until one night in a restaurant in Ramallah where I was with a couple of my former Berkeley students by chance. You know, I hear my name being called across the restaurant and I look and there's Ramzi. I said, well, what are you up to? He said, oh, well, I'm back from France and I'm opening up music schools for the children of Palestine. That began the journey.
And he opened a music school, Al-Qamanjati, in 2002.
2005.
2005. He started thinking about it back in 2002.
He was thinking and thinking and thinking, but he started actually experimenting and implementing and bringing some of his friends from France, fellow musicians, down to see what it would be.
much of your book, The Children of Stone, focuses on Ramzi Abu Redwan. When the first intifada broke out in 1987, he was 8 years old.
Right.
He was raised by his grandparents who lived in the Al-Amiri refugee camp on the outskirts of Ramallah. What was about his story, besides that poster that you saw, that compelled you to write 400-plus pages? Not just about him, it's also about the impacts of the occupation on ordinary people, and also possibilities, as you said, that Palestinians do imagine even living under such hard conditions.
First of all, it's an amazing story, the story of Ramzi, story of a kid from a camp, a refugee camp, who grows up with this dream and then actually learns to play music and keeps his dream, and then becomes sort of like a Pied Piper, and all these people start following his dream. He's a very inspiring person. And the fact that all these musicians from all over the world came to help him and all over Palestine was part of the appeal, and just the drama of doing something truly beautiful under such exceptionally harsh circumstances, that being the Israeli military occupation of the Palestinians in the West Bank since 1967. So then it's the story also of these children and how Ramzi used to like to say, or still does, my reason for doing this is to protect these children from these soldiers, which, you know, sort of sounds like a soundbite at first. Well, how can music do that? And then he starts seeing the kids talk about it, and the teachers talk about it, and of course Ramzi talking about it. And then I did some research, and there's a lot of studies that show that music can be truly transformative, not just in the moment that you're playing, but it gives you a different sense of who you are. It kind of unlocks something and helps you, you know, sort of reorient your circuitry in a way. And that's what was happening with a lot of these kids that was being reported to me and that I could see for myself at times. So all of that attracted me, but there's also, I think there are so many, there's so much denial in the general culture in America of, or just not any discussion of, the impact of the occupation on the Palestinians. And basically, the daily reality of half the people in this conflict is essentially off the American radar screen. So what I thought this great story of Ramzi and the music school gave us an opportunity to do was tell that story in the process. Talk about the incredible hardships that these children have just going by in their daily lives. So it would be a way of explaining and exploring and documenting the occupation without it being in a polemic, without it being, you know, sort of speech making or a study. You could just see these kids at checkpoints and so on.
And I think you capture what you're trying to do in the prelude of your book, Over the Wall, to play Beethoven.
Yeah.
And it's Ghalandia military checkpoint between Ramallah and Jerusalem in summer of 2003. This is about musicians who are trying to go to Jerusalem for a concert.
Yeah.
And because of the checkpoint and because of the wall, their movement is so restricted that they have to risk their lives in order to be able to go there.
I wanted people to get a sense immediately of the visceral feeling of what it's like to live in an occupied land. And yet, you know, what this sort of extraordinary mission of this group of musicians, and in fact the book is, which is to talk about the efforts to make music under occupation and the extreme measures that people will go to. Just in this case, to play Beethoven's Fourth Symphony at a French church built in Crusaders times in the old city of Jerusalem. So the idea that you could have a story like this, you're kind of literally dangling in the air at the end of this section, and then what happens in the prelude, then the story is elaborated in five parts. So it's kind of a parallel drama to the rest of the book.
And also, as I said, at the time of the first intifada in 1987, Ramzi was just only 8 years old. But his life in the refugee camp under occupation defined him. When did music enter his life?
Well, there were several place is sort of early on. I mean, one of the things that he told me was, you know, his grandfather was a street sweeper. He was a municipal garbage worker. And at Ramsey's insistence, when he snuck around and followed his grandfather to work one morning, which is kind of how I opened the book, he really loved working with his grandfather. His grandfather was a refugee from the village of Nani in Old Palestine. And he would just follow him around and sweep the streets with him. And he was like so impressed that his grandfather, he said, you know, his work was like holy. He was so devoted to his work, even though his work was in garbage. And they would find things on the street that they would salvage and bring home, or maybe they would patch up some clothes and sell them or whatever. And one day they found a teddy bear on the street. And Ramsey pulled it, and it played the notes of the Ode to Joy from Beethoven, this Ninth Symphony. And he used to play it at night while his grandfather was sleeping. And they shared the same bed often. So that was one moment. And then there was a moment where there was a fellow who they called Teacher Holiday. Teacher Holiday was maybe second grade, something like this. And one day he bought out a box of instruments and gave him maracas and tambours or whatever, and he brought out his kamanja or his violin. And Ramsey said, you know, his whole face, his whole being was transformed by that. And Ramsey looked, and that's part of what gave him that idea of being a musician. But it wasn't really something that he had in his mind until he had a concrete opportunity at age 16 or so.
And you have a passage in the book that sort of parallels his own experience when he was a little kid with what he saw when he was talking to a group of kids in a school for the disabled in the West Bank. And that is when the idea for this music school suddenly, it sparked in his mind that, what if I do that? And I thought that was one of the most beautiful passages in the book, because of the relationship that he really developed instantaneously with these kids.
Right.
And he could observe how transformative music can be. And I would like you to read it if possible.
Sure. A few days after his arrival from France, Ramsey sat in a chair at the front of a classroom at the Center for Rehabilitation, a small school where handicapped and able-bodied children learn together. He smiled at the children, his bouzouk in his lap. In the same refugee camp 17 years earlier, he had watched Teacher Holiday open the magic cabinet full of musical instruments. Ramsey looked around the room at the artwork taped onto the walls. In front of him was a large scroll of butcher paper, partly unrolled across a 10-foot patch of floor, revealing the children's artwork. Between the images of birds and trees, orange fire exploded from tank barrels. Soldiers confronted mothers and children at checkpoints. Houses burned. Ramsey had visited classrooms in France, too, and there the children just drew houses, sun, and trees. Children are children, the same everywhere, he believed. They draw what they see. Ramsey began to strum his bouzouk, playing a soft instrumental version of Il Khalwadi, the beautiful girl. He played folk and revolutionary songs for 30 minutes, then went home, looking up at the red roofs of Psagot, the Israeli settlement on the old hill of Jabal al-Tawil. Recently, at the height of the Second Intifada, the settlement had begun marketing Kava Vin Psagot to Jews in Israel and beyond. A website boasted of a Cabernet Sauvignon aged in a special cave containing winemaking implements that date at least to the time of the Second Temple. A few days after his visit, Ramsey returned to the school for rehabilitation. This time, the children surrounded him, wide-eyed, touching the bouzouk. One by one, Ramsey would play a note, then reach out for a child's hand, placing his or her finger on the fingerboard. In this way, the children could hear the change in pitch. "Hey, this is magic," someone shouted. This was the same feeling Ramsey had experienced as a boy, staring open-mouthed as Teacher Holiday transformed himself into a kamanjati, a violinist. Before he left, Ramsey looked out onto the scroll of butcher paper, where days earlier he had seen images of rockets, tanks, and mothers in distress. Now he watched children trying to draw musical instruments, violin, bouzouk, and oud. In the moment, Ramsey had a simple epiphany tied to his history and his music. "I thought it would be more useful for your country if you're still alive, you know, than if you die, killed by a soldier in the beginning of your life." Now, he thought, his idea, which he dreamed of calling Al-Kamanjati, the violinist, could actually work. Previously, the school had existed in the abstract. Now, with children in a war zone drawing musical instruments after hearing Ramsey play for only half an hour, he saw that music could help safeguard his people's children. Next year, he said to himself, I will come back, and I will do the work.
This was in 2002, and 3 years later, he established a school in Ramallah.
Mm-hmm.
This was not the only music school. You're right that after the 1994 Oslo Agreement, tens of thousands of Palestinians long exiled by Israel were able to come back. And among those was Mohammed Fadel, mm-hmm. a violinist trained in musical therapy and established the National Conservatory of Music in Ramallah.
Mm-hmm.
And 4 years later, in 1998, Professor Edward Said, together with Israeli pianist and conductor Daniel Barenboim, also created West Eastern Divan Orchestra. And the title is based on a set of poems by Goethe. These Western-centric music projects had different missions. And you also have Kamanjati that came out later in 2005. So for someone like Ramzi, who grew up in a refugee camp and had experienced first intifada, he was a stone thrower himself, you know. And
sure,
one day he's going to the conservatory, but on his way he sees a car filled with settlers coming down the alley, and he throws several stones at them, and then he just turns back and just goes to school and doesn't talk about it. Resisting the occupation was an organic part of their being. So where did he fit? Where did he, someone like Ramzi, fit in this new environment before he started this school, of course?
Well, I think it works on several levels. One is he never stopped playing Arabic music. He never stopped playing the bouzouk. It was always the bouzouk and the viola. His formal training as a classical musician, of course, was with the viola, which began in Ramallah at the National Conservatory of Music, which is now the Edward Said National Conservatory of Music. So he was always in both worlds of music, Arabic or so-called Oriental music, and classical, Western classical music. And, you know, Ramzi would say, nobody owns Beethoven. He belongs to the world. So he doesn't make such distinctions. But I think what was also a practical matter was that these scholarships were giving a chance for him to do something different with his life. It could have been, if he had a propensity for art, maybe it would have been something else, or writing. I mean, he just was drawn to music, had the opportunity, and this was a way for him to become something outside. The interesting thing is he could have had a career as a classical musician in Europe. And he had that opportunity, and yet he was always grounded in his dream, which was to come back and bring that to his own people. So, in a way, he used his training as a tool to do what he wanted to do all along.
He was a student at the National Conservatory of Music, of course, and he played with Thivan. And at some point, Ramzi's vision about the role played by music in the lives of Palestinian kids diverged and clashed with that of West Eastern Divan Orchestra. How did these different music projects see the relationship between music and politics in general and occupation in particular?
Well, it's a very good question. I mean, one is that when Edward Said died, I think that Maryam Said took on his widow took on a very large role in organizing. But I think nevertheless, especially a liaison to the Arab musicians in the orchestra, which these are musicians coming from Syria, Lebanon, Egypt, as well as Palestine and other places. But I think that the dynamic shifted a little bit. And I know a number of the Arab musicians felt like it was becoming more of an Israeli-dominated orchestra. I don't know personally if that's true, but I've certainly heard people talk about that. I think what happened, you know, Ramzi felt that Daniel Barenboim was personally quite courageous in the stances that he would take. You know, he accepted a major prize, Israeli prize, and took the opportunity of the speech to denounce the occupation. I mean, not everybody would do that. But he did not agree with Ramzi that the orchestra itself should also take a stand and denounce the occupation. And Ramzi spent quite a while trying to convince the rest of the orchestra that we have to make a stand. We have to. And then after there was the Lebanon War broke out in 2006 and Israel was attacking Lebanon, there were Lebanese people in the orchestra. A lot of people didn't show up. And that was the first year Ramzi was there. And he's like, wait a minute, I thought you guys were progressive and I don't see that you want our freedom. And so he started questioning it and he kept trying to sort of reform the organization. But Daniel and even Miriam Saeed both agreed that the example of the orchestra before the world, that there can be harmony, is power enough. And Ramzi disagreed. He said, that's not power enough because I need to know that everyone in this orchestra believes in my freedom. And I think in the end, he did leave the Divan. And although he remains, I think, quite fond of Daniel Barenboim, they just had differences, philosophical differences. And I think, you know, I've interviewed both of them at length, particularly Ramzi, but also Daniel Barenboim several times. And, you know, you can tell they really like each other, but they just had this irreconcilable difference over the role of the orchestra and whether it should make a more pronounced stand behind the Palestinians.
It was intensified with the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement.
That's absolutely true.
Because Daniel Barenboim did not understand what it was all about, if I'm not mistaken. He says something to that effect in the book.
What's interesting, and sort of serendipitously, the narrative of the Divan Orchestra and Ramzi's involvement in it and his disagreement with Daniel Barenboim that we were just talking about parallels the deterioration in the situation on the ground in Palestine, and in particular the erosion of the sort of Oslo-era dialogue. You know, let us just understand each other's pain and history and let's be a witness to each other. That was a big, you know, I personally think that can be extremely powerful. But for Palestinians, they note that at the beginning of the dialogue era, if you want to call the Oslo era, which was signed on the White House lawn, the Accords, Yitzhak Rabin and Yasser Arafat in 1993, there were then 109,000 settlers on the West Bank, not including East Jerusalem. Today, there are 350,000. Mm. There are more bypass roads. The lands of Palestinians are like an archipelago of islands. And so Palestinians understandably ask, what did this get us? What is all this dialogue and witness to each other? And so the direct confrontation, nonviolent action of the BDS movement and of Palestinian state efforts to join the UN and the International Criminal Court are responses to the situation on the ground and the fact that Israel has not been negotiating a two-state solution in good faith, and the two-state solution is essentially dead now. Mm. So I think Daniel Barenboim wants to still think that we should be in that era of dialogue, and I think a lot of people don't realize that that era has been pretty much discarded by Palestinians because it didn't work.
It was Sharon who said that I'm going to turn the West Bank and Gaza into pastrami sandwich.
Yeah. Layers of settlement.
Exactly, layers of settlements. And you say that Daniel Barenboim took this personally.
Yes.
You write that it was difficult for Daniel not to take it personally. As an individual, he had repeatedly put himself on the line in his own country for advocating for Palestinian cause, declaring solidarity with the plight of occupied Palestine. What was it about boycott, divestment, and sanctions that Mr. Barenboim did not understand?
I can't speak to that specifically.
Did you talk to him about
this? I don't think I talked to him in general. I'd have to go back to my notes. I don't recall if I asked him about his opinion about BDS. But I think in general, I mean, he's pretty much of a two-state solution person. Of course, BDS does not insist that one be a one-state solution person. But I think that he has not made the conversion to the sort of post-Oslo direct nonviolent confrontation of Israel and the strategy of essentially shaming Israel in the international arena. I think that goes beyond his comfort zone. If I can't say exactly what his position on BDS is, but I would say for that reason, he probably is beyond his comfort zone. Mm.
He also features several kids who go to Al-Kamanchati.
Yeah.
And some young girls and the difficulties they face.
Yeah.
Can you talk about some of these wonderful young men and women that you met along the way as you were writing this book?
Yeah, I'm happy to. I mean, that's part of what inspired me to keep going and try to make this into a really page-turning tale, because I feel committed to telling their story accurately and with heart. And I'm happy to tell you about a few of them. I mean, the girl who's on the cover of the book is Ala Shalalda. She was the first student at Ramsey School. She wandered in one day when he had all his school set up and it's beautiful and all the instruments, but no students. You know, he was told me he was sort of twiddling his thumbs at first. And what do I do now? And here's this little girl, 7 years old, who wanders in, and Ramsey's playing his violin and or his viola. And she's like, whoa, why do you play it like that? And he's like, come over here. Why don't you look in the rooms and see what looks good to you? And she started touching the piano, and she had never seen a piano before it arrived and a month or so earlier, and except for, she told me, on a Tom and Jerry cartoon. And then she picked up the violin, and then he said, you know, that's a lot of work, the violin. And she said, you know, I don't care. I will do it. I will do the work, too. So that's one girl. Her older sister, Rasha, was quite a talented flute player. And their older brother, Shahada, has become the instrument maker of Al-Kamanchati, the luthier and the instrument repair guy. You know, Rasha had an opportunity to be the first girl from Al-Kamanchati to study abroad. And the family was not, especially the father and Shahada, the oldest brother, was not comfortable with her studying unaccompanied. And so he opposed her scholarship. And that became very tense in the family. And then Rasha got married, and she's still playing the flute. And she's got a degree in journalism now, I believe. So, and she's got, I think her boy is maybe 5 years old now. So, but they're living near in the ancestral village near Hebron.
How did music impact their lives? At some point, I think it was Ala, she says that when she plays the instrument, she feels very calm.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
She sort of transports herself into a completely different world, which doesn't look anything like her real life.
But Rasha talked about how I just feel, yes, transported, like I'm in the forest with this blue lake, beautiful sea, not like the Dead Sea, and I feel the sense of freedom. And all these people around her reported, you know, that this very traumatized girl, traumatized during the Israeli incursions in the Second Intifada, along with Allah and the whole family. I mean, Shahada saw one of his best friends shot dead when they went to try to escape the curfew, break the curfew to get bread, and his best friend was shot and killed right beside him. And this family was very traumatized during the Second Intifada. So Rasha and Allah reported that there was a sense of protection they felt from the music. And Rasha herself, according to many people I talked to, went from a very angry, traumatized child to this self-respecting young woman and musician.
And also for Ramsey, Al-Kamanchati School was also a model of resisting the Israeli occupation. So he would take sometimes these kids, or he will try to take them to the checkpoint. Was he ever concerned about taking these young kids to the checkpoint and having them face Israeli soldiers?
Well, there was a discussion about that. There was a similar incident where they were thinking about crossing the line between Israel and the West Bank, in one of the few places where there's not a wall still, in this beautiful village of Batir. And there was a big fight about whether or not they should go, and Ramzi wanted to provoke and wanted to go. And other people were saying, what if a few of these teachers get arrested and they're banned from coming back? And, you know, then what happens to the school? And what if you're arrested, Ramzi? And so he relented and they didn't cross that line. I think there were other similar discussions. There have been some teachers around, some parents that have expressed some concerns, but I think Gramsci sees his work in music just as much as when he was a child throwing stones as a form of resistance. Mm-hmm. And so people will say, maybe they don't tell him into his face, but they'll say, Ramsey, you know, he's more political than musical. He's more into politics than he is into music. But for Ramsey, I don't think there's... You can't have one without the other. You can't live in a situation under the occupation and do anything that's not somehow a statement. And so, I mean, these kids, they wanted to do... There's an amazing event at the Columbia Checkpoint that I end the book at where these kids are playing Mozart's Fourth Symphony. And little Ala, well, she was now... I guess she was probably 14 then when I talked to her about this, and she... After this concert, she had the most serene smile I have ever seen on her face, you know, and she could be kind of a frowning kid, sometimes brooding, you know, and she was only 14 at the time or whatever, but she's like, this was the best concert of my life, you know.
Sandy Tolan is an award-winning journalist, documentary radio producer, and associate professor at the Annenberg School of Communication and Journalism at USC. He is the author of a number of books on Israel-Palestine, including The Lemon Tree, and his latest, Children of the Stone. From Pacifica Radio, this is Voices of the Middle East and North Africa. Khalil Ben Deeb, and this is Voices of the Middle East and North Africa. When asked about the misconceptions about Afghan people, foreign correspondent Anna Botkin replies, quote, I think there isn't a whole lot of conception of the Afghan people. If you get your information about Afghanistan from television snippets, you see Afghans as two-dimensional figures in unfamiliar clothes that move across our television screens, foreign and strange, almost cartoon-like, unsung. One goes up, one goes down. At the very best, they are generalized as victims or evildoers. Most commonly, they are simply statistics. In her new book, The World is a Carpet, independent journalist and storyteller Anna Botkin chronicles how she spent a year in Oka, a village in northern Afghanistan which is not registered on any map, including maps of Afghanistan. Through a close observation of the ancient tradition of carpet weaving, Anna Botkin chronicles the daily lives of the 240 residents of this isolated village in all its complexities and simplicity. And she spoke about it with Melihe Razazan.
The village epitomizes Afghanistan to me. Most of Afghanistan is small villages that are not, maybe even if they are on the map, some regional map, they're not on the map of the Afghan government. They're definitely not on the map of the West that is conditioning life in Afghanistan. Much of Afghanistan lives rurally. 80% of Afghans live in villages. Much of Afghanistan has seen the effects of the billions of dollars in international aid that the West has poured into Afghanistan in the last 12 years. Conversely, much of Afghanistan has not seen the direct effects of the U.S.-led invasion. There aren't villages, or there are, but there are not a whole lot of that are bombed out. There are not a whole lot of villages that have been raided by NATO troops. However, war is omnipresent. Destruction is omnipresent in the way there is no infrastructure, in the way relief and health care are tremendously delayed. And so for that, Oka is very representative.
In your book, you say, I saw Oka in 2010 when I met Baba Nazar and his family and watched for the first time his daughter-in-law squat upon the loom. The visit had lasted an afternoon. I had to return. I had to return and spend more time here, the time it took to weave a carpet. What was about the weaving of a carpet that inspired you to go back and chronicle the daily lives of the 240 residents of this tiny village in northern part of Afghanistan?
Two main things. One is, in my work, what I try to do, explore the gray area within the tension between the devastation and the beauty, the poverty and the charity, the violence and the survival. And so for me, to be in this village that is absolutely destitute and forsaken and devastated in a way by millennia of war that has been waged upon the Afghan soil, and at the same time, where people produce such beauty, that attracted me, that pierced me, the dissonance, the friction between the violence and the beauty. So that's one reason. And the other reason is that carpets, Afghan carpets, are familiar to my audience, which is an American audience or a Western audience. Probably a lot of people who are listening to us have Afghan carpets in their living rooms. So this was an opportunity for me to tell a story from a very unfamiliar angle, because the story is told out of Afghanistan. It's not me looking into Afghanistan. It's me trying to look out of Afghanistan, tell the land, tell the journey of this year the way Afghans see it, but at the same time throwing a very familiar line, if you will, a thread, a carpet yarn to my audience, something that is familiar, a common denominator, something that people who are reading this book in English in the United States can say, oh, this brings it home. So for that, carpets were important.
You know, there is a passage in your book where you describe Thora, who is a carpet weaver in Oka, about how the pattern, the color, the thickness of the carpet reflects her daily life in Oka.
A carpet weaver in Afghanistan, unless she works in a factory, if she's working from home, she performs a very difficult job, but it's not slave labor. It's not morning to dusk, hour after hour, day after day, monotonous, never standing up. No, it's part of her life. So she's a carpet, but she's also a mother and a daughter and a daughter-in-law and a sister. And she also probably has to look after some animals, maybe some chicken. And so she also has to maybe cook lunch for her husband. So when she does sit down at the loom, she's interrupted very frequently. Her baby cries. She needs to stand up and make sure that the baby's okay, maybe nurse the baby. Or a neighbor walks into the loom room and starts telling sex gossip from the newlywed's house, and the women start laughing. And the weaver is once again distracted. Or the weaver's sister gets married in a nearby village and the weaver leaves the carpet for a couple of weeks. So all this happens with the carpet participating in it. For example, she gets distracted. She forgets the count of the knots that she's tied so far and accidentally weaves an extra petal to an almond. Or she gets distracted and misses a leaf, or she spills her tea upon the carpet. Her baby is born upon the carpet. Chicken walk onto the carpet, and she has to shoo them away. You know, their bird droppings and their feathers get stuck in the weave, and all of that is accumulated in that weave. So the carpet becomes more than a decoration. It becomes the diary of this woman at the loom.
And I think something you said in one of your interviews is that people who own an Afghan carpet, or for that matter, any carpet, really, you want them to look at all those designs and patterns and think about who made them and what went into making a carpet.
I hope that my audience, regardless of whether they have carpets, will try to imagine what life in Afghanistan is like. I hope that the book helps transport them for an afternoon or an hour, however long they take to read the book, to this land that is not as far away as we want to think. It's much closer. It's very familiar.
And I want to read that passage that you were just describing. I think it's so beautiful. You say, "Here the weaver ran out of burgundy yarn and switched to the crease left over from some older weaving. The depth of color in the border changes suddenly. Here a goat ambled into the loom room and the weaver jumped up to shoo it away. The lotus flower grew an extra petal here. She forgot the count of the knots she had already tied before she settled back to work." So can you talk about the journey that this carpet takes from a hut in Oka to a living room in Europe or in the United States?
The carpet is rolled up, pile side in, and thrust into a pannier of a donkey. And then the weaver's husband or father-in-law or brother, a male from her family, takes the carpet to the nearest carpet merchant in the nearest town. That carpet merchant buys the carpet probably for $200 or $300. And then that carpet merchant in turn sells that carpet to a merchant in a larger city, for example, in Mazar-e-Sharif, which is the largest city in northern Afghanistan. From there, the carpet has three directions in which it can go. It can go south to Kabul, probably by bus in the cargo hold of a passenger bus over the Hindu Kush Mountains, Kabul, to the airport and to Dubai by plane. And from there, it can go directly to London or New York or Washington, D.C. or San Francisco or Frankfurt. Or the carpet can travel from Mazar-e-Sharif west on the old Great Silk Road to Turkmenistan, and from Turkmenistan to Turkey, where it will end up in the Grand Bazaar of Istanbul, where a tourist might buy it, or maybe somebody from a wealthy Turkish family might buy it. Or the carpet may travel via Kabul to Jalalabad, which is a town on the border between Afghanistan and Pakistan, and then cross the border over the Khyber Pass and end up in Peshawar. Usually carpets from Peshawar also end up in the West. So most of these routes bring the carpet to a Western consumer.
And you actually took that journey with the carpet to Kabul, and then from Kabul to Jalalabad, try to find those carpets that end up there.
I followed the carpet route to the borders, both with Turkmenistan and with Pakistan. I did not actually cross, because the purpose of this journey, the purpose of this book, was not to follow a carpet. The purpose of the book was to tell a story of Afghanistan the way Afghans themselves see it. So I did journey to Jalalabad, and actually past Jalalabad to the Khyber Pass that connects Pakistan or separates Pakistan from Afghanistan, depending on your philosophical view. And I also traveled to the border north of Andhoy in western Afghanistan, to the border with Turkmenistan.
So let's talk about people you met in Oka and you wrote about. Something that struck me was that everyone in Oka smokes opium. Women drink it with their tea and men smoke it. And you write about this infant, Zakurullah, who was taken to the hospital because he had some degree of opium poisoning and he was dying, basically, but they were able to save him. And you also write about boys in Oka who are allowed to smoke opium when they turn 15 years old. or they get married, whichever comes sooner. So why is opium consumption so pervasive in this village?
Because it's the most available and often the only available medicine in Oka. The nearest hospital is a 7.5-hour walk from Oka. So if somebody in Oka gets ill, the only medicine, painkiller, the only reliever of woe available to that person is opium. Opium is supposed to have been brought to Afghanistan by an invader, by Alexander the Great. His army used opium as a palliative. Mm. And opium remained and remains today in places like Oka, which have no other access to health care, a predominant palliative. Malihe, children in Oka die because the wells in Oka are diseased. Mm. Children in Oka die because of a common cold. Mm. Children in Oka die because of dysentery in the summer and the flu in the winter. Also, women will take opium to stave off hunger, give opium to their children to stave off hunger.
What about the issues of electricity and water? Because there is, again, one passage in your book that you talk about a generator that was brought in to provide electricity to the residents. And then when the generator ran out of diesel, it became so expensive to sustain it. Basically, it has just been sitting there and nobody even cares about using these generators. So first off, who brought this generator to Oka?
Nobody in Oka could really tell me who it was. The people who physically delivered the generator were Afghan. Mm. They probably belonged to some well-meaning NGO, or maybe some subcontractor working with an NGO. So they delivered the generator. They also built 12 aluminum electric poles and stretched a power line from one pole to the next and to the next. They did not connect the power line to anything else, nor did they connect it to the generator. The generator came and the villagers ran it nonstop to calculate how much it would cost them to run it every evening for, say, a couple of hours. And once they ran out of fuel, they realized that it would be simply too expensive to use a generator because nobody in the village has any money to spare. So they never used it after this one dry run 6 or 7 years ago. And I think that that generator stands there like a monument to the misguided effort to renovate or resurrect, rebuild Afghanistan. Because here it is, you know, the effect, the tangible effect of international relief, international aid, the generator that cannot run because nobody can afford to run it. Mm. An absolutely useless piece of mechanics that will never be put to use because the people for whom it is intended simply can't afford it.
What about water?
There are water wells that have water. The water is diseased. It has tested positive for typhoid and a bunch of other diseases. So they use this diseased water that they draw hand over hand from these two fairly deep wells. All wells in northern Afghanistan are very deep because there is almost no surface water. It's a desert.
This place is not on the map of Afghanistan. Can you take us through this village and tell us what it looks like? And besides carpet weaving, what else people do in this village to make a living and to survive?
Oka is a tiny hamlet of about 40 cob homes that sit on top of a loess hummock. And around it is a convex desert that stretches to the north and the west and the east until it curves into the horizon. And in the south, it is trimmed by the Hindu Kush Mountains. They're about 40, 50 miles away. Nothing grows in Oka because it doesn't have any surface water. It only has these two very, very deep wells. So there is absolutely no farming, no cultivation of anything at all. The two sources of income for the villagers are carpet weaving and bartering of caligonum, which is this thorny brush that grows in the desert, as kindling for rice and oil and flour, wheat flour. So men and boys will go into the desert with their camels and their donkeys and gather heapfuls of caligonum and pile it on top of their pack animals and take the animals to the nearest big villages where things do grow and trade the caligonum for basic necessities such as rice or oil or wheat flour or sugar or tea. And the women will weave carpets. It takes between 4 and 9 months to weave a carpet, depending on the size of the carpet and how many women are actually weaving it. So those are the two pretty much only sources of income for the villagers.
Were they surprised that someone from the United States is interested in their story?
I don't know if they were surprised. They were certainly curious because they couldn't understand what it is that I was doing. Nobody in Oka, except for the owner of a very small bodega, can read. So the idea that I was writing a book about Oka is very difficult to convey to the villagers. And one time, one of my friends there asked me, why is it that I come to Oka? Because he thought that it was such a difficult place to be, and he had to be there, but I didn't. Hmm. So why did I choose to come there? And I said, and this was around the time of the tsunami that hit Japan in 2011, and the villagers were listening to the radio and listening to the news from Japan. And I said, you know how listening to the news from Japan and you're imagining what it's like to be there right now? Well, in order for you to hear the stories from Japan, somebody like me has to be in Japan and tell these stories. And so what I'm doing here in Oka is I'm trying to record your story so that I can tell it to people in the United States. And the next time somebody asked my friend what Anna is doing in our village, my friend said, she's going to talk about us. And here I am talking about Oka on the radio. Hmm. So in a way, he was absolutely correct.
I was surprised to read that even Taliban is not interested in this village.
The village has nothing to offer. The Taliban is only interested in places where they can either hide and you... Well, there are no trees in Oka, so it's rather difficult to hide there, or where you can collect a tithe, a 10% religious tax. And, of course, in a village that has no money, there is nothing to collect. Mm. So, of course, the Taliban is not interested in Oka.
But at the same time, when there was that wedding, the musicians never showed up because Amin Bai in Oka, he told you they were afraid. He clarified by saying that they were afraid of Taliban because 6 months earlier, you write, in Torai, Taliban gunmen had opened fire during a wedding because there had been live music and dancing. Now musicians avoided traveling to weddings in villages they did not know well. Even some wedding photographers in Kabul cannot take wedding pictures and they get threatened by Taliban.
Yes, there actually have been assaults on wedding photographers and assaults on wedding musicians because, of course, and assaults on photographers, by the way, were not necessarily by the Taliban. Sometimes the family of one of the sides in the wedding is more conservative than the other, and they disapprove of the notion that somebody would photograph the bride, for example. Mm. It's not the Taliban alone who are very traditional. Much of Afghanistan society is very traditional, very conservative. The wedding I attended, all the guests were asked to not use their cell phones because everybody has a cell phone with a little camera on it, and the villagers wanted to protect the dignity of their families and the dignity of their wives and daughters and sisters and make sure that none of the women in the wedding were photographed by the male guests. So the idea of not photographing at the wedding doesn't just come from the Taliban, which is, you know, just one representation of conservative thinking.
Hmm. Anna, your book reads like a poem as it describes the simplest and the most complex parts of life in this small village, Oka, in northern Afghanistan. And I really had to slow down in order to be able to adjust myself to the rhythm of life in this village. Was that intentional?
I'm glad you're saying that the book made you slow down, because I think in order to survive Afghanistan, we must slow down. On the one hand, time, the way we perceive it in the West, is irrelevant in Afghanistan, because in a way, Afghanistan itself is timeless. Its perpetual war is timeless. And Western time really means nothing in the Khorasan, because it abides by its own clock. It's a clock of snow, of spring, of kidding ewes, the clock of Ramadan, the clock of the spring solstice celebrations. So when you come to Afghanistan, you sense, if you allow yourself to let go of your preconceived setup of time, the time will pull and unfurl in the valleys and crevices around you at a pace that has been set by millennial wars, by ancient connections, by harvests, by scars, by conflicts, by celebrations. But at the same time, Afghanistan doesn't exist outside time. That would be a conceit, because it doesn't exist outside the world, except the way Afghanistan travels with time is it speeds itself up and then slows down to the condition, to the cadence of life itself. So, for example, the landmarks, the milestones of time in Afghanistan are a wedding, a Taliban attack on the United Nations compound, the seizure of a certain village by insurgents, you know, maybe the killing of Osama bin Laden, or maybe not. And what I was trying to do with writing the book in the very particular rhythm was to allow my audience to adjust to this time, to adjust to this pace that Afghanistan set.
Anna Botkin is an award-winning freelance war correspondent who has covered conflicts in Africa, Asia, and Europe. Since 2001, she has reported regularly from Afghanistan, the setting of her new book, The World is a Carpet, Four Seasons in an Afghan Village, in which she chronicles the lives of the residents of Oka, a small village in northern Afghanistan. She spoke with Maliheh Razazan. To learn more, visit jadmagazine.com. From Pacifica Radio, this is Voices of the Middle East and North Africa. And that's it for us this week. Voices of the Middle East and North Africa is produced at KPFA Studios in Berkeley.
To get in touch, you can call us at 510-848-6767, extension 632. Email vomekpfa@yahoo.com. Connect with us on our Facebook at Voices of the Middle East and North Africa, or follow us on Vomina Radio. Please join us next time for another edition of Voices of the Middle East and North Africa.
TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Captain Paul Watson. When the oceans die, we die. When Captain Paul Watson, co-founder of the Sea Shepherd Conservation Society, returned from exile in France, TUC Radio broadcast an interview with him. It surpassed in downloads all programs of 2016 except for one. So here's an update. Sea Shepherd is an international non-profit marine wildlife conservation organization. Their 1977 founding mission is to end the destruction of habitat and the slaughter of wildlife in the world's oceans. With their fleet of 10 ships, they confront Japanese whalers in the Southern Ocean, prevent rogue fishers from finning shark, protect tuna and dolphins. Sea Shepherd crews have arrested poachers, removed illegal fishing nets, and chased vessels back into their home ports. There's dramatic footage of a captain who's now in jail, sinking his own ship to destroy the evidence of poaching when confronted by Sea Shepherd. And you will hear more intriguing campaign details in a moment. Sea Shepherd's decades-long practice of aggressive nonviolence has led to charges of piracy. However, Sea Shepherd's legal team defends the organization's right to enforce international conservation laws in neutral waters, partly because nobody else is doing it. There are now also many examples of Sea Shepherd assisting small nations that have no resources to confront the international vessels that plunder their territorial waters. Courts in many jurisdictions have sided with Sea Shepherd, with the notable exception of the U.S. 9th District Court in 2012. The U.S. court sided with the Japanese whalers and told Watson to stay away from the whaling fleet. Even though in March 2014, the International Court of Justice ruled that the Japanese whaling program was not as claimed for scientific purposes and ordered Japan to cease operations, the U.S. District Court is standing by its ruling. In spite of appeals by Sea Shepherd's lawyers, it is now enforcing a court-mediated monetary compensation of $2.5 million to be paid by Sea Shepherd U.S. to the Japanese whalers. On August 23, 2016, a preliminary injunction which prevents Sea Shepherd's U.S. branch from disrupting Japanese whaling operations in the Southern Ocean became permanent. However, Sea Shepherd is an international organization, and the Australian branch is not bound by the U.S. 9th District Court decision. Australia, in fact, has declared Japan's hunt in the Southern Ocean whale sanctuary to be illegal. However, Australian Federal Court Judge Jim Alsop has stated, "There's no practical mechanism by which orders of this court can be enforced." End quote. Well, Sea Shepherd offers a mechanism of enforcement, and they are getting ready to use it right now. As this program goes out to you in late November 2016, Sea Shepherd Australia is outfitting their most recently added vessel, the Ocean Warrior, to confront Japanese whalers who already left Japan on November 18, 2016. Behind all the legal issues, the reasons and ideas and vision of Sea Shepherd might get lost. Co-founder Captain Paul Watson is one of their most eloquent spokespeople. While still in exile in Paris in January of 2016, he was interviewed by Aurélie Aimé, who is part of the Chou Brave TV collective. They touched on remembrance, vision, ideas, climate change, children, diversity and interdependence, and even food. And above all, why exactly we humans will die When the Oceans Die. Aurélie asked Paul Watson if he remembered when he first took action on behalf of animals. They spoke in a coffee house with some music in the background.
I wanted to know if there were moments during your childhood or after when you understood how fragile the nature was or how beautiful it was, if there were some key moments that made you do what you're doing now.
Well, I started doing what I was doing when I was 10 years old because I lived in a small fishing village in eastern Canada. And when I was 10 that summer, I spent swimming with a family of beavers. And every day I went down there, played with the beavers. And the next summer when I went back, they were all gone. And I began to ask questions and found out that the trappers had come in and killed them all during the winter. So I got pretty angry. So that winter, when I was 11, I began to walk the trap lines and free the animals and destroy the traps. And so I've been doing that ever since, really.
So what do you think we should teach our children?
So I'm always asked this question, what we can teach our children? And my answer to that is nothing, absolutely nothing. What we need to do is listen to them, because children intuitively know where they belong. You know, look at your average six-year-old. I mean, they know more about most things than average adults. You know, when I was 6 years old, I was into dinosaurs and birds and whales and everything like this. And I always had adults telling me not to do this or not to do that or not to think this way or not to think that way. And, you know, this is what adults tend to do, is tell their children what not to do when they should be encouraging them their passion. Back in the 70s, we gave a series of three talks in the Queen Charlotte Islands, which is a Haida Indian reserve. And the first was to kindergarten, the second was to middle school, and the third was to seniors. And went to the kindergarten first. And first, we had two questions. The first one, how many people here speak Haida? Every kid there spoke the Haida language, 6 years old. How many people here know about whales? Didn't have to say a thing, just listen to the kids tell us about whales. By the time we got to middle school, half of them spoke Haida, half of them knew about whales. By the time we got to the seniors, not one of them spoke the Haida language, and their attitude on whales was, who cares? So what we did was we took all these beautiful, beautiful, intelligent kids and turned them into complete idiots through our educational system. And this is what our educational systems do. They tell people not to think. They tell people how to behave, you know, what to believe, how to go about things. And we really need to listen to children and not tell them what to do.
And so you have led many actions for the sea and for also earth animals. Could you tell us which are the greatest actions, the biggest action you have led through the years?
I don't really look on them as like one action being more important than the other. I think whether you're protecting phytoplankton or whales, you're protecting biodiversity in the ocean. So all of those campaigns are equally important. So it's hard to really say which one's, you know, bigger or more important, really.
So which ones were more significant for you? Emotionally or important because you have they had a big impact, or I don't know, maybe.
Well, I there's a lot of them. I think that probably the best way is what was the most successful campaigns are. You know, we fought the Japanese whalers in the Southern Ocean for 10 years and ended up, like last year, they killed none, but they're coming back, but we'll keep fighting them. It took us 35 years to shut down the commercial seal hunt in Canada. It's still a seal hunt, but it's not a commercial seal hunt. So you have to have a lot of patience, because these campaigns, you know, you don't accomplish anything overnight. We've been fighting the killing of pilot whales in the Faroe Islands since 1983. This year, our biggest success, I mean, this last year, was we shut down all the illegal fishing vessels in the Southern Ocean. We chased one for 110 days. It was the longest pursuit of a poacher in history, and the captain scuttled his own boat off San Tome to keep us from getting the evidence and arresting him. And so he and the two officers were sentenced to prison for that. But we shut down six of the vessels this last year. And so that cost the Spanish companies that were behind these illegal operations tens of millions of dollars.
Okay.
Our two vessels are in the Sea of Cortez protecting the endangered Vaquita, which is the smallest and most endangered dolphin in the world. We have one vessel in the Mediterranean, which will be going against illegal fishing in southern France, and also in Sicily in March and April. Our Cove Guardians are on the beach in Japan, you know, trying to protect the dolphins from being slaughtered there. And we're sending our vessel, the Bob Barker, to Africa in next month to go against illegal fishing there. Our vessel, Steve Irwin's leaving in next week to go pursue illegal activities in the Southern Ocean, that is toothfish poaching and illegal whaling by Japan. We're working in partnership with Biosphera, which is an organization, Cape Verde, to stop poaching in that country. And well, we have so many campaigns, it's hard to really keep up with it. But we have hundreds of volunteers working at any given time.
One of the priorities would be protecting the endangered species. And
What we do is really a focus on illegal activities, illegal fishing, illegal killing of whales, illegal sealing. 40% of all of the fish that's taken out of the ocean that people buy in restaurants or in stores is caught illegally. And so that's a significant factor shutting that down. You know, although we're opposed to all fishing, all commercial fishing, we concentrate on the illegal activities because that allows us to be successful because we're really upholding the laws and you know, have that sort of backing behind us. And that keeps us pretty busy in itself.
And do you feel things are evolving in the right way?
Well, I think as far as people becoming more aware of things, yes. People are much more aware now than they were 30 years ago, 20 years ago, 10 years ago. It's a growing movement in that way. Are we evolving fast enough? I don't know. Time will tell. I think we have some very serious situations that we have to deal with right now. One of the factors is that this planet was never made for 7.5 billion fish and meat-eating primates. It just wasn't meant for it. And we're literally eating the ocean alive. Even when people eat meat, they're eating the ocean because 40% of all of the fish caught from the ocean is fed to pigs and chickens and domestic salmon to house cats. So it's a bizarre situation where the largest aquatic predators on the planet are chickens, pigs, and domestic house cats.
You think one of the solutions could be people going closer to vegetarianism, or
no? It's not one of the solutions. It's the only solution. Mm-hmm. The world has to adapt to a plant-based diet, or else we're not going to survive. We're killing 65 billion animals every year, and that's producing more greenhouse gas emissions than the entire transportation industry. The world transportation industry produces 14% of the greenhouse gas emissions. The animal agricultural industry is 24%, so it's 10% even more. You know, a vegan driving a Hummer contributes less to greenhouse gas production than a meat eater riding a bicycle.
Oh. That's significant.
I think that everybody has to look at what kind of footprint they're leaving on the planet. You know, everything that you do, how does it contribute to making this planet either a better place to live for the future or not a very good place to live for the future? So that's really how you look at it. Our ships fly the flag of the Five Nations of the Iroquois Confederacy. And the reason they gave us a flag, and we're the only ships that fly that, is because the Iroquois Confederacy and Sea Shepherd have a mutual understanding, and that is that we both agree that you shouldn't make any decision in your life until you take into account the consequences of that decision on all future generations. And that, I think, is the way we have to live our life. When you do something, well, what is this going to mean for the future? It really comes down to two ways of thinking. One is what we all used to be, which is of a biocentric point of view. And one is what most people are now, an anthropocentric point of view. The biocentric point of view is that we're part of nature. The anthropocentric point of view is we're in charge of nature, we're the only important thing, everything revolves around us. And only indigenous cultures still retain that biocentric point of view. But there's also this thing called the continuum, and that is the continuum of time. For instance, if you ask your average person in Europe or America or whatever, you just say, what was your great-great-great-great-great-grandmother's name? The year's 1500. What was her name? What'd she do? They don't know. They don't care. I mean, what's that got to do with anything? You know, that's their attitude. But if you go to the outback of Australia and you ask an Aboriginal that question, or you go into the Amazon rainforest and ask a Kayapo Indian that question, you'll get a name, and you'll get details about the person's life because these are people who knew where they came from. And because they know where they came from, they know who they are. And because they know who they are, they know where they're going. So that means a child born 500 years into the future is very much a part of their reality now. Our society doesn't think like that at all. We don't really think about what kind of future we're leaving to children tomorrow. We forget about what happened in the past. And because we have no past and we have no vision, we don't even know where we are today.
Also, I think there's less and less people who have a spirituality, who believe in there is more to us than just a short period of time on this earth. Are you spiritual? Do you believe that there's more to life than just...
No. I don't really think it's anything that we should even worry about. Gertrude Stein once said, the answer is there is no answer. That's the only answer you're ever going to get. So why are we wasting our time fighting each other over who's right and who's wrong? Nobody knows what the reality is. What we do know is that all the religions in the world are anthropocentric religions. They all revolve around humanity. And God is a human being, or humans are God, or whatever. God's made in our image. Basically, we just created all of this, you know. So to me, religion is just everybody fighting over who's got the better imaginary friend, you know. spiritually, I believe in the laws of ecology. I believe that the earth is a living entity, that all things require biodiversity, that every living system has that biodiversity. And within that biodiversity, you have interdependence, the law of interdependence, that all of those species are interdependent with each other. And then, of course, the third law of ecology is the law of finite resources, that there's a limit to growth and a limit to carrying capacity. And we're stealing the carrying capacity of other species so that we can increase the numbers of our own species, which doesn't make any sense. I mean, people get upset when I say things like worms and bees and trees are more important than people. And the reason I say that worms and bees and trees are more important than people is simply because worms and bees and trees are more important than people. Because for the simple reason, they can live on the planet without us, but we can't live without them. So that makes them more important than we are. Mm. The problem right now is that we're destroying interdependence because we're destroying diversity. And that means that right now we're in the sixth major extinction in the planet's history, the last one being 65.2 million years ago. And this one, we're the reason for it. We're the cause of it. But I don't really get depressed because I do know that it takes 18 to 20 million years to recover from a major extinction event. So 18 to 20 million years from now, this will be a really nice place.
And you've still got... What still gives you the energy to continue this fight, seeing what human being does?
In 1973, I was a medic for the American Indian Movement during the occupation of Wounded Knee in South Dakota. We had seized the community to protest the fact that the Fort Laramie Treaty of 1868 was being, you know, ignored by the U.S. government. The U.S. government responded by surrounding us with about 2,000 troops. They were firing 20,000 rounds a night at us. It was, you know, a very, very dangerous situation. They killed two Indians and wounded 46. And I asked Russell Means, who was the American Indian Movement leader at the time, I said, you know, we don't have any hope of winning here, so why are we doing this? And he said, well, we don't do what we do because we're concerned about winning or losing, and we're not concerned about the odds against us. We do what we do because it's the right thing to do. It's the only thing to do, and that's why we're here. So what I learned from that is that you don't focus on the consequences. You focus on the doing. And so that's what we do. We intervene and we don't worry about whether we're going to win or lose. We just have to do our part. So we need to give the ocean a chance to revive. Now, example, in Polynesia for, you know, thousands of years, there was a concept called taboo. The shaman would say, this area is taboo, like a bay. No fishing for 20 years. And they were very serious about it. You caught a fish there, it was a death penalty. You did not touch those fish because they understood that their survival depended upon, you know, having that biodiversity there. And so there's no taboo areas in the world anymore. Everything is being exploited everywhere. Even the marine reserves, that's where the poachers go because, you know, they've killed everything everywhere else. So we have to allow the ocean to regenerate. How do we do that? The governments, what they need to do is stop all subsidies on industrial fishing. We spend $75 to $100 billion a year subsidizing industrial fishing. Shut that down, and you'll shut down most of that industrial fishing. And the reason why they do this is because things have changed over the last 50, 60 years. The little fishing town I was raised in, small fishing boats went out there causing enough destruction by themselves. But the problem is that there's not enough fish for them to do that anymore. We've removed 90% of the commercial fisheries during the 20th century. In order to get that last 10%, you need heavy equipment. 100-mile-long gill nets, 100-mile-long long lines, super trawlers, giant purse seiners, bottom draggers. These boats cost anywhere from 100 to 150 million euros each. You know, nobody can afford that unless you get subsidies from the government. So the governments are basically subsidizing the destruction of the oceans. We have to shut down industrialized fishing operations. And if we do, the ocean will revive. Just look at the 20th century as a good example. The two times during the 20th century that the ocean recovered slightly, World War I and World War II, when we stopped fishing for five-year periods, and they started to come up, and then we knocked it down again. So I believe that in 40 to 50 years, if we leave the ocean alone, it will revitalize itself. The second solution is that we have to switch to a plant-based diet worldwide. How that's going to be done, I don't know, but it's the only way I think that we're going to be able to survive. But we just cannot continue to kill 65 billion animals every year, and we can't just simply cannot afford, ecologically, we cannot afford to have this kind of lifestyle. Aside from the ethical issues involved, it's the ecological issues which are going to destroy us on this. The third solution, again, is one that isn't very, you know, it's simple to me, but unacceptable to most, and that is shut down all military operations in the world, get rid of it, all the armaments. You know, we spend enough money on so-called defense every year to provide every man, woman, and child on this planet with medical care, water, and food and shelter. Every single person could be provided that if we just took away that military budget, which is it's just obscene. There wouldn't be any need for war if everybody in the world was given a guaranteed annual income. And we can afford to give everybody a guaranteed annual income by simply not having a military. But the problem is human beings are ecologically insane. And it's a disease which has afflicted them emotionally, spiritually. And it's a form of, it's a psychopathic sort of situation. And I'm not sure really that can be remedied other than the extinction of the human species. You know, I came to this realization in 1975. We came up with this idea to save whales in the Pacific from the Russian whalers. And our idea was to get between the harpoons and the whales and put our lives on the line to protect them. We were reading a lot of Gandhi at the time, and we figured that, you know, that's going to work. So in June of 1975, Bob Hunter and I were in a small little boat in front of a Russian whaling vessel. It was coming down at us full speed, and in front of us were eight magnificent sperm whales that were fleeing for their life. And every time the harpooner tried to get a shot, I would maneuver the boat and block his harpoon. And that worked for about 20 minutes until the captain on the boat came down the gangway, and he screamed into the ear of the harpooner, then he looked at us and he went like this and smiled, and that's when we realized Gandhi wasn't going to work for us that day. And a few moments later, there was an explosion, the harpoon flew over our head, hit one of the whales in the back, and she screamed and rolled on her side, blood everywhere. And the largest whale in the pod suddenly hit the water with his tail, dove and swam right underneath of us, and threw himself right at the bow of the Russian boat to protect his pod. And they were ready with an unattached harpoon, and they shot a harpoon at point-blank range into his head. He fell back screaming and rolling in agony on the surface, blood everywhere. And that's when I caught his eye. And he looked at me. He dove, and I saw a trail of bloody bubbles coming straight at us real fast. And he came up and at us at an angle, so the next move was to come right down on top of us. And as his head came up out of the water and I looked into his eye, that really changed my life. Because what I saw was understanding. That the whale understood what we were trying to do, because I could see the effort he made to pull himself back, and he began to sink back into the sea, and I saw his eye disappear beneath the surface, and he died. He could have killed us, and he chose not to do so. So I owe my life to that whale. But as I sat there, and the sun was going down and in the middle of the Russian whaling fleet, I began to think, why were the Russians killing these whales? You don't eat sperm whales. They're unedible because of the high concentration of myoglobin in the flesh, which, because they're deep diving whales, so the meat is a blackish meat on that. But what they do is they make sperm oil out of the meat and spermaceti oil out of the reservoir of spermaceti oil in the head, and that's a very high heat resistant oil, which is used in industry. And one of the things that it was most in demand for was for the construction of intercontinental ballistic missiles. And I said, here we are killing this beautiful, intelligent, socially aware, socially complex, self-aware, sentient being for the purpose of making a weapon meant for the mass extermination of human beings. And that's when it struck me. I said, we're insane. We're totally insane. And that's when I said to myself, I'm not here to work for people anymore. I'm here to work for whales and fish and sharks and whatever. But, you know, when people say, well, you know, how come you don't protect people? Because we're crazy. Yeah, we're just completely crazy.
Yeah. Okay, thank you. Thank you very much.
That was Captain Paul Watson, co-founder of the Sea Shepherd Conservation Society. He was commander on 7 different Sea Shepherd ships since 1978.
Welcome to GroundRock Community Radio News, brought to you by volunteers at Canada's community radio stations.
This episode of GroundWire was produced on Anishinaabe Territory, part of the Robertson-Superior Treaty, home of the Fort William First Nation in Thunder Bay by Carly Forbes.
We're your hosts, Michael Foldvari
and Patricia Pizzi-Liang.
From CJLO, 1690 AM, broadcasting from Concordia University on Mohawk Territory in Montreal.
In this episode, Algonquins of Barrier Lake travel to Ottawa to protect their territory from mining. Trent Radio makes their station more accessible, and this.
I was the baby that was being held in my mother's arms while they were marching on Parliament Hill. I was the one in the protests being passed around the back while my mother was speaking in the Supreme Court.
Politicians were saying that we needed to take care of the Muslim problem, and we're going to do it to protect the gays. Which, I mean, as a queer Muslim person, like, it just doesn't make sense.
But first, here are the headlines.
The Kurdish community in Canada has been organizing rallies since November 4th to protest the Turkish government's latest attack on the Kurds and the arresting of 11 members of the Kurdish party. Hundreds of people gathered at Yonge and Dundas in Toronto, City Hall, and at the Turkish Consulate in Toronto, in front of the Manitoba Legislature in Winnipeg and in Ottawa over the past 2 weeks to protest the arrests of the People's Democratic Party, HDP, MPs, including co-chairs Figen Yüksekdag and Selahattin Demirtas. Arrest warrants have been issued for all 59 HDP MPs whose immunities were lifted months ago as part of the war on civil liberties in Turkey, with the pretext of fighting terrorism. Only 3 days prior to the attack on HDP PMs, the mayors of Diyarbakir, politically and symbolically the most important city for the Kurdish people in Turkey, were also arrested and imprisoned. HDP is a party which earned the votes of at least 6 million citizens in 2015 and is the nation's third largest party. These attacks are considered a continuum of the campaign against the civil rights and liberties of the Kurdish people. Hundreds of people have died and tens of thousands have been displaced due to the military campaign and curfews in the eastern provinces that followed the HDP's electoral success in June of 2015. In addition to this, since the July 2016 coup attempt in Turkey, over 170 media outlets critical of government policies have now been banned. Kurdish, Alevi, and socialist media have been effectively silenced, and just last week, 370 NGOs and civil associations have been shut down. More than 130 journalists are in prison, including some renowned authors and intellectuals. Farhad Sultanpour, president of the Kurdish Association of Manitoba, said,
We are calling upon the Canadian government to lead the international community in condemnation of these illegal acts, demand the release of the Kurdish MPs, and reinstate the mayors. Gretchen King from CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal brings us this headline from the International Institute of Communications conference held recently in Ottawa.
The Canadian chapter of the International Institute for Communications convened its annual conference this November at the Shaw Centre in downtown Ottawa. The event brought together business and government leaders in broadcasting, media, telecommunications, and technology. This year's theme focused on creating an innovation agenda. Community radio was noticeably absent from the conversation. Groundwire asked one of the panelists, Catherine Canoe, CEO of the Cable Public Affairs Channel, to comment on the value of nonprofit media participating in the conversation about innovation.
I think everybody does bring something to the table. I think it's just a matter of maybe knowing more about this organization and what they do.
The lack of diversity in the room did not escape the Honorable Navdeep Bains, Minister of Innovation, Science and Economic Development. In his presentation at IIC, he described an innovation agenda that prioritizes equity. Groundwire asked Minister Bains how this should be put into action.
Innovation requires a large talent pool. Good ideas can come from anywhere, anyone. So it's incumbent upon us to include more women, more young people, more Aboriginal people, more people with disability.
Marie-Philippe Bouchard, president of TV St. Canada and board member of IIC Canada, agrees this year's conference outcomes present an innovation agenda inclusive of a diversity of Canadians and media organizations.
We were incredibly lucky in Canada because it's very diverse. It's an open system that was very successful. We're in a period of big change, and so we have to be focused on the prize, and the prize is that we have to innovate together.
To view the conference proceedings, search for IIC Canada in the archives online at www.cpac.ca. Reporting for Groundwire, this is Gretchen King from CKUT Radio in Montreal.
The next headline was written by Carly Forbes.
On October 31st, a $600 million class action lawsuit was filed on behalf of civil servants and military members who were dismissed on the basis of their sexual orientation. It's estimated that wrongful dismissals between 1950 and 1992 affected over 9,000 people who were investigated, targeted, sanctioned, and or were discharged or terminated by the Government of Canada because of their sexual orientation, gender identity, or gender expression. In the 1960s, Pierre Trudeau decriminalized homosexuality, but the government saw LGBTQ Canadians unfit to serve in the military, at the RCMP, and even the National Film Board, the CBC, and the Canada Post. The case is expected to be assigned a judge and begin in court in the next few weeks. MP Randy Bossoneau was appointed the LGBTQ2S Special Advisor to the Prime Minister on November 2nd, and Prime Minister Trudeau is expected to issue a formal apology.
That's it for the headlines. We'll be right back after this.
Fire.
You're listening to Groundwire, available at groundwirenews.ca and broadcasting from your local community radio station.
You just heard Sometimes by Izque. Now it's time for our feature stories.
Algonquins from Barrier Lake have set up a land defenders camp to protect the land from mining. Darren Sutherland, host of The Circle on CHUO, interviewed Barrier Lake community member Norm Machawan.
We have a camp set up on our territory to oppose the mining that's going to happen in the Parc de la Variandrie, which is three and a half hours north of Ottawa. If this mining comes through, it's going to contaminate our lakes and waters, which connect to the Ottawa River and which will flow down here in Ottawa. It's not only my community or the Algonquins of Barrier Lake that are going to be impacted by this, but, you know, the whole Ottawa River watershed that's going to be impacted. And my community is set up right now to stop the drilling process that's going to be taking place until April 2017. The mining on the territory has been under suspension since 2011.
Oh, wow.
But it was in 2010 we found out through the Mining Watch Canada that there was going to be a potential mining in the territory. So we did check it out right away. We did not waste any time. And when we did check it out, it was in the heart of our traditional territory. And we have a lot of users on our territory, you know, not only us, but we have different communities, our neighboring Algonquin communities that use the territory as well, and the non-native hunters. And, you know, we're trying to preserve the wildlife reserve for all our users. We're not going to let Copper One Company bury our identity alive, you know, because much of our identity comes from the land, our language, our culture, our teachings. It's going to be a huge loss for the community and a huge loss for, you know, for this country to lose such a great wildlife habitat.
You aren't necessarily opposed to development. You just want it done in a respectful, sustainable way.
Yes. Well, in Quebec, you know, there's no process in place for a consultation with the First Nation community. They just go online and they stake a claim through the Google Earth.
Oh, geez.
And there's no consulting us, you know. And, you know, we would have never agreed anyway, you know, because it was right in the heart of our traditional territory where more than 25 families will be impacted. And, you know, a lot of lakes, a lot of river systems where the sturgeons rely on, and, you know, the people rely on that, the animals, everything. You know, everybody needs water, including Trudeau and Premier Couillard.
And CKCU's Roots Radio interviewed Chief Casey Ratt.
Basically, right now we have, you know, some families that are camped out near Junction 29, which leads to the where Copper One has a claim on the territory for an 80-kilometer-wide mining activity that they want to, you know, do in our territory. So right now we're trying to make sure that the drilling of the exploration drilling does not happen within the territory for whatever reason. And right now. Copper One says the Copper One and MNR have said that there is no drilling at the moment, or no permits have been issued, which is good news for us.
You know, you have a long history of combating resource extraction industries and the province. So, who's all implicated involved? You mentioned Copper One, but is that the only kind of player in this?
Well, right now we have 14 mining companies that want to do exploration drills in our territory. So we're out there making sure that this does not happen. We have people, you know, taking rides into the territory on these locations, making sure that you know, no one is there doing these activities. And if they are found to be at the at these locations, the community will go over to that place and ask them to leave the territory and make sure that they don't come back in the future, because, you know, we don't want no mining in our territory. You know, if there's any mining in our territory, I mean, it's just going to devastate the community because our people still use and occupy the land that is recognized as the trilateral agreement.
Thank you to Braden Alexander for producing that report.
Following the U.S. election, demonstrations have been taking place in cities such as Vancouver and Montreal, protesting the election of Donald Trump. CKUT's Jneba Dale recorded a speaker at the anti-Trump demonstration in Montreal.
Among other things, we need to fight for a better electoral system, electoral reform. Trump lost the popular vote, and he was still elected president. The Liberals here in Canada don't have the popular vote, and yet they form a majority government. So we need to fight for that, both in Canada and the U.S. We need a voting system that actually reflects the real preferences of people. So those are things I believe we can do in the short term. But more fundamentally and more importantly, we need to acknowledge that the values that are at the base of our economic system are the values that determine the ones we have in our culture. There are certain questions we need to ask ourselves. For instance, how do we concretely transition to an economy that is founded on human values? What would that economy look like? And we need to put the intellectual labor towards answering those questions. But we need to remember that the problem is far from being just economic, because the same people that were left behind by neoliberal policies and capitalism in the States are also the same people that agree with Trump when he says that society is too politically correct. These are the same people that think that the Black Lives Matter movement is divisive and needs to stop. These are the same people who don't think that trans people should be able to choose the washrooms that they use. These are the same people who try to defend sexual assaulters. These are the same people who oppose women's reproductive rights. And these are the same people who are scared of immigrants and refugees, largely speaking. So there's many facets to the battle that we have to lead, and it's not just economic. And I think that what is most needed right now is for people to be educated. And it's not my place to tell people to put that labor into doing that, because it does require a lot of intellectual labor and it requires a lot of emotional labor to engage with people who fundamentally disagree with us. And I acknowledge as well that it's hard for a lot of people to even enter those circles and to be taken seriously within those circles.
Co-op Radio's Gunnar G. O'Sullivan spoke with a queer Muslim protester at the demonstration in Vancouver who responded to the Trump administration's proposed database of Muslim immigrants.
As for the anti-Trump rally after the Pulse shooting in Florida, Trump and other politicians were saying that we needed to take care of the Muslim problem, and we're going to do it to protect the gays, which, as a queer Muslim person, like, it just doesn't make sense. Like, the Audre Lorde Project put out a statement around that. I'm just going to read you a quick line to that. They say, the fact that only the race of the perpetrator and not the victims is being discussed is telling. Besides erasing the lived reality of Muslim, LGBT, STG, and C people, Black Muslims and LGBT, STG, and C people of color more generally, this promotes a xenophobic stereotype that Muslim people and immigrants are more homophobic and become radicalized elsewhere. The culprit becomes the figure of the Islamic terrorist, and the heroes become the politicians, the police, and the military. We reject this deliberately racist framing. Individual perpetrators are part of a much larger system of militarization and colonization. We recognize that terrorism is not imported. It is homegrown in a culture that is deeply anti-Black, anti-immigrant, and anti-queer.
So you say no to Trump?
I say no to Trump.
The Motherhood Initiative for Research and Community Involvement, known by its acronym MERCY, held its 20th anniversary conference in October in Toronto. One of the speakers was the outgoing president of the Native Women's Association of Canada, Dawn Mimi Lavelle Harvard, who now prefers to go by the name Mimi. Mimi recalled attending the first Mercy Conference 20 years ago with her mother, Jeanette Lavelle. Lavelle, a lifelong activist, sued to remove the part of the Aboriginal Act that excluded women and their children from status if they married a non-Native man.
In the most traditional form of activism and educating and mothering, I was the baby that was being held in my mother's arms while they were marching on Parliament Hill. I was the one in the protests being passed around the back while my mother was speaking in the Supreme Court. And I grew up in a family where I thought everybody did protest signs and banners for arts and crafts. I have proudly continued this tradition with my own daughters when we were at a protest, actually, last summer, and it was had to be about 45 degrees, and we were boiling out on Parliament Hill. And I noticed my three girls who were marching alongside me, and they're looking at the RCMP cruisers, and I'm worried because I thought they were getting nervous about, you know, the presence of all the police around us, given our histories. And they're eyeing these police cruisers, and they're looking at me like, what's going on? It's just, I bet those cruisers have air conditioning.
My name is Fiona Green, and I'm at the University of Winnipeg, and I'm a professor of Women's and Gender Studies.
And you're here at the Motherhood Studies Conference. Tell me about how Motherhood Studies fits into your discipline.
It is my discipline. My PhD research was on feminist mothering. In 1995-96, I began. And I attended the very first conference that Andrea O'Reilly put on in 1997. And I've been a member ever since.
Professor Green credits York professor and Mercy founder Andrea O'Reilly with putting motherhood studies on the map academically. In its 20 years of existence, Mercy has held 50 conferences in Canada and around the world. They publish a biennial journal of motherhood studies, and they also publish books under the label Demeter Press. Green has published 3 books in the field of motherhood studies.
Practicing Feminist Mothering, Maternal Pedagogies in and Outside the Classroom, and Chasing Rainbows, Exploring Gender Fluid Parenting Practices and Essential Breakthroughs, Conversations About Men, Mothers, and Mothering.
I asked Professor Green to explain more about that last title.
Well, it's based on a lot of theories, but in particular looking at Sarah Ruddock's work on maternal thinking. And she argues that the work of raising children, the work of attending to children, preserving them, nurturing them, helping them socialize, be accepted into society, that takes a particular kind of thinking, and that it's not biologically necessary that it's women who do it. We live in societies that structure that women do that. And so the argument in that essential breakthroughs is breaking through the assumption that it's only women who can do maternal work.
There were 155 registered speakers at the October Mercy Conference, and they came from many countries, many fields of study, and many social perspectives. Here are a few examples of topics discussed. Transparenting, neoliberal pedagogies of motherhood, maternal experiences of Bosnian women rape survivors, Aristotle's exclusion of mothers from the political sphere, Canadian newspapers' stereotyping of single mothers, public child care in Finland, mothering's effects on a child's neurobiology, the rhetoric of the breast milk supply, the end of collective child rearing on an Israeli kibbutz, mother artist rebellions in the UK, the symbolism of mothering a disabled child. For more about Mercy's conferences, journals, and books, visit their website, motherhoodinitiative.org. For Groundwire, I'm Frieda Worden.
Frieda Worden is series producer of WINGS, Women's International News Gathering Service.
Sun dogs chasing morning skies. Look down the road and we drive and drive. The washboard road, the sparkling snow. We squint our eyes, we squint our eyes. How are we to know? How are we to know? We sip our tea beneath the arbor light. Smoke, you watch it curl and rise. The dancers know which way dust blows.
Listening to Groundwire, available online at groundwirenews.ca and broadcasting on your local community radio station.
You just heard Sundogs by Tara Williams.
Now it's time for our community radio report. Josh Skinner of Trent Radio CFFF interviewed station staff about improvements recently made to the station to make it more accessible to people with disabilities.
Over the summer of 2016, Trent Radio decided to improve our accessibility to our community broadcasters through the installation of a ramp at the front door and a wheelchair-accessible bathroom. Trent Radio did this because it believes that to be a community broadcasting facility, it has to be available to the whole community. Today, we are joined by longtime general manager John Muir, the summer operations manager during the installation, Haley Raymond, and current Community Outreach and Development Manager Maurizio Interiano to discuss what these accessibility improvements mean to the community.
My name's Haley Raymond, and I'm currently an assistant at Trent Radio just a couple hours a week during the school year. It's a student job. Over the summertime when the renovations were going on, I was also the Summer Operations and Information Manager. Well, over the summertime, we had our bathroom renovated, so we got the doorway to it widened, and we also got things like a lock button instead of, like, you know, something you have to fidget with. And yeah, it's much bigger. The whole thing was expanded as well as the doorway, so it's become wheelchair accessible. Anybody can do a radio show at Trent Radio. You can come in and you can talk about whatever your passion is, but I mean, the first step to doing that is being able to get in the door and have access to things like, you know, basic things like a washroom. So it's really important that we can facilitate having an inclusive environment and being open to having as many people come to make radio as we can.
This is John Muir about to talk about what accessibility means at Trent Radio.
Barrier-free means autonomous, so you want people to be able to participate on their own steam without having to wait, you know, around for other people to do things for them. It's possible these days, if you have a smartphone, to do a radio show on it and submit it to Trent Radio and we'll get it broadcast. It's a fairly lonely pursuit. There's something to be said for conspiring with others, or at least even if you're not actually conspiring in terms of your production, but getting ideas, getting encouragement, giving encouragement, that kind of thing. That part of participation to me is just as much as part of making a community as are the output of the radio shows. It's almost like a double negative. If you don't have people who are in that situation, then you notice they're missing. If they're there, then you don't notice they're missing. So in a way, I want people not to be missed.
My name is Maurizio Interiano, and I am currently the Community Outreach Development Manager. There's a big social aspect to Trent Radio, and I think when people are able to come into the studio and come into the kitchen, they're able to have those social encounters with everyone here. They're able to have a face-to-face conversation with their operators and with other programmers. So just the fact that we have doors that are big enough and open enough for everyone to come in and experience the social aspect of Trent Radio, it's vital to creating community. When you tag a place as being fully accessible, people feel welcome. And I think we've always tried to make Trent Radio a welcoming place, and this will just encourage other people to come here and do programming. So I think that will be very important to really have a diverse programming.
Thanks for listening, everybody. This has been a production produced in Peterborough's community broadcasting facility, Trent Radio. And if you ever find yourself in town, please feel free to visit us at 715 George Street North. Thank you.
That's it for this edition of Brown Wire, produced on Anishinaabe territory in Thunder Bay.
Music this week was by Is Quay and Tara Williams.
Headlines this week were written by Julia Arick, Gretchen King, and Carly Forbes.
We also thank Greg McDougall,
Darren Sutherland,
Andy Crosby,
Braden Alexander,
Glenn S.,
Josh Skinner,
Ume Salma Ramtula,
Gennarji O'Sullivan,
and Geneva Dale.
Tune in again to hear Groundwire on your local community radio station
or download at groundwirenews.ca.